have to, it will have, if it's to succeed on the electoral level, it will have to be done.
Shaw on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking with Pennsylvania State Representative James Rohrbach about this, again, this horrible voucher bill they're trying to ram through as we speak. They're on the floor now. They're arguing. You know, again, just trying to ram something down the throat. And, you know, one of the things that popped into my mind, talking with my Tea Party dentist. And look, I like my dentist, decent guy, still one of these tea twizzlers.
I am the Tea Party people.
Yeah, you are. And his big concern is, well, they rammed that health care bill down our throat. They rammed, in a hurry, an entire year it took to get that health care bill to a vote. A year, an entire year. To the tea twits, that's ramming it down your throat. This voucher bill that they're talking about right now today got off the printers last night. And they're going to make that law today. At some point, can we start screaming they're ramming it down our throat? That's what we're going to talk with James Rohrbach about that. Hopefully get some time off the floor as he is attempting to defend public schools in this state. Also, we're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, about the voucher bill, the legal part of it. Is it constitutional? You look what we talked about yesterday in Colorado. The courts out there said, you know, their funding mechanism, what they're doing to fund the schools, unconstitutional because it didn't give every child an opportunity. At some point, we need to be looking at that. And also in the second hour, Andy Barris, Director of Development and Communications at the National Law Center on Homelessness and Policy, going to be here talking about the voter ID bills that are going to be suppressing votes all across this country, including right here at home. And I still can't get over McElhaney's statement. There's no proof. No one's shown me any proof that this would stop anything, but my governor asked me to do it. And I'm going to do it. And the people in the House asked me to do it. So I'm going to follow the leader. And like I said yesterday, kind of reminds me of what my mother always talked about a bridge and friends and jumping and all. You know, I think you've probably heard that. Is that what Senator McElhaney's doing? You kind of got to wonder. When he says, there's nothing there, but I'm going to push it through anyway. And then I think it really shows what it's about. It's about holding down people's right to vote. So we're going to be talking about that. What's on your mind? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I don't know if you saw this. The financial sector now makes up a larger share of the economy than any time before the Great Recession. The latest numbers coming out of the Department of Commerce now put the financial sector's portion of GDP at almost 8.5%. That eclipses its peak, which it hit back in 2006. And understand, in the 50s, you know, the fabulous 50s where they want to take us back to, the financial sector accounted for less than 3% of our GDP. What we used to do is we used to make things. We used to make stuff here. You know, we had manufacturing. We used to create. We had entrepreneurs and inventors. And we're losing that. Now what you're seeing is you're seeing these financial firms, they're making more than 30% of all corporate profits in the U.S. So what we've done is we've really done what Reagan wanted to do. He wanted to create a nation of service, a service-based economy, a nation of people washing cars and cutting grass and watching children and cutting toenails and whatever else people do for each other without actually creating any wealth. And look where we are. We are beholden to the big banks. We are beholden to the criminals on Wall Street. And we are giving away that productive ability that we once had. And you look at this story from Reuters. And it's not surprising. Something I've been talking about for the longest time. It's now that the Chinese have decided that, you know what, U.S. Treasury is not giving us a good return. All the money that they're plowing into the Eurozone, not going to give them a return. They're setting up their own sovereign wealth fund, $300 billion. They're going to go and they're going to buy things. Reuters reported last week that the People's Bank of China planned to create this new vehicle. They're going to have two funds, one in Europe, one in the U.S. And the idea, we're not buying any more debt. We're not buying any more of your promises. No more treasury bonds, no more any of this. We're buying you. We're going to buy your factories. We're going to buy your parks, your roads, your bridges, your colleges. We're going to buy you. And soon, if the Republicans over here in the House get their way, your public education. They're buying up utilities. They're buying up. They're doing what we used to do because they learned. We're the dumb ones in all this. We're the ones who somehow got it in our mind that we can shuffle papers around, that we can gamble and we can do all these trades and we can create wealth out of nothing, out of thin air. We are such wonderful people, such creative beings that we can create wealth out of absolute nothing. Somehow we've convinced ourselves, and I'm not sure how that happened. But somehow we've convinced ourselves in this country that, yeah, we're gonna create wealth out of not making anything. And now what's being rammed down our throats by the geniuses in Washington and these metal giants over here in Harrisburg is, well, what we need to do is we need to cut. We need to cut public spending. We need to cut public services. We need to cut wages. We need to get rid of benefits. We need to cut entitlement programs. We need to cut Social Security and Medicare. Cut, 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 cut. You know, the idea of no pain, no gain. You know, because if we're not suffering, you know, we can't move forward. This idea, and I'm not sure where it came from. And I think the best words that ever were spoken on this came out of Krugman's mouth. The confidence fairy. That if we do these things and you get your things in order, that the confidence fairy will sprinkle some dust and all the people who are sitting on tons of cash, the people on Wall Street, will then have the confidence to take that money that we have given them and use it to help us. Now, the confidence fairy doesn't exist. I think any rational, reasonable person knows not happening. But that's what's going on in Europe. That's what they're talking about doing here. This idea that if we cut, if we slash and burn and we take people's pensions, that somehow, that's going to tell the people with money that we're serious. We're really serious about being business friendly and that you should come bring your money to us. And it doesn't work. It's never worked. It defies logic. But that's what keeps being told to us. We need to cut government spending. Okay, let's do that. What's going to, when the fire department no longer comes to your house, what then is going to take the place of that? Well, a private for-profit company. Okay, and if I don't have the money to pay for the fire protection, what happens? Well, they'll come to your house and watch your house burn down. And we've seen that happen in Tennessee. Or, better yet, well, we just won't pay the firemen. We'll bring in prisoners and let the prisoners put out the fires like they want to do in Georgia. Does that seem like a good idea to you? I mean, does it sound rational? Does it sound reasonable? I don't think so. And that's why there are people in the streets all throughout Europe saying, no, slash and burn, cut, gut, and punish does not work. It only makes things worse. Now, this idea that somehow if we squeeze enough and we make people suffer at the bottom enough, that will give them the ingenuity to pick up themselves and pull themselves up by their bootstraps. If we steal their boots and take their bootstraps, they'll whittle it out of hair. It hasn't worked. What you need is an infrastructure to allow that growth to happen. And we're cheating ourselves. We don't have world-class transportation in this country. We don't have 21st century telecommunications. We don't have, I was looking at photos of the Beijing airport. Wow. Absolutely amazing. Why? They invested huge amounts of money in it. They move more people through their airport, somebody was telling me, than LaGuardia, JFK, and O'Hare put together. Think about that. Yeah, we can't seem to get out of any of those places in under a couple hours. And what do they want? They want to continue to slash and burn. We don't need to upgrade those. We don't need to build new airports. We don't need to build new telecommunications. We don't need more new transportation. We don't need upgrades. No, let's live off of the investments of the past and go after some insane balanced budget amendment that nobody has proposed a budget that would pass the balanced budget amendment. So we're going to pass a balanced budget amendment saying, yes, we're going to have a balanced budget. Yet for the next 20 years, nobody sees that happening. So what did we do? We spent a whole lot of time talking about nothing. And I look today. You know, they had the big vote. Had to have the vote on it. Understand, we are 3 days away from shutting the government down. 3 days away from the next hostage situation, the next crisis, the next cliff. 3 days. You've got these Republicans who put Mike Lee, one of the co-sponsors of the balanced budget amendment, called it one of the most important pieces of legislation to come before the Senate in decades. Somebody needs to check whatever it is he's smoking. It went down 47-53 party line. And basically it was just lip service. The reality of the balanced budget amendment, if we were to enact a budget that would truly balance the budget, that means we'd have 15 million more people unemployed. Our unemployment rate would double to 18%. Our economy would shrink by 17% instead of growing by 2%. We would continue to constrict, continue to cave, and continue to swirl right down the drain. And there's part of me, and like I said this yesterday, there's part of me that truly believes the Republicans want that to happen. Because that's the only way they win in 2012. Because if the economy continues, you know, just to move along at the slow pace that it has, they're not going to be able to, say, throw the bums out. If it falls and unemployment goes up, they go, well, see, it's not working. And they're trying. They are absolutely trying everything they can think of. To me, what needs to be happening, the conversations we need to have, and I don't think it's any surprise to anybody who's listened to this, smart trade policies, smart tax policy, smart investment, build our infrastructure, tax people who have the money, who have done wildly well, so that they can make more money off the investments that we're making in our nation. But for me, it all starts with trade. I mean, I go back to 1975, the last year this nation, as a nation, had a trade surplus. A good. I don't know what the number is. Probably 40% of the nation is under, is younger than that, 35. So in 30% of the people at least, they in their lifetime have never had a trade surplus. Never. The Chinese have got us by the short hairs, and now they're starting this wealth fund, $300 billion, where they're going to go around the globe and they're going to buy things up. They're going to buy us. They're going to buy factories and roads and bridges and hospitals and schools and everything. No more here. We're going to invest in your nation. No, those days are done. And they're telling us that. And they're going after us with tariffs as well. You know, I guess we've had some car sales that have been going on. We've been doing a little bit better selling cars over there. So what have they done? They're going to slap a tariff, which they already had a tariff on to begin with, but they're going to slap an additional tariff on GM products, Chrysler, Mercedes-Benz made here in the U.S., and BMW made here in the U.S., as well as Honda. Why? Well, because we've slapped tariffs on them for really, truly, well, killing us. Look at the solar panels. Look at the steel tube. Look at the tires. Look at all of the cases that have gone to the WTO and we have come out on the right side of. So the question becomes, where do we go from here? This election cycle is about righting this country. I think if we go the wrong way this year in 2012, well, it's going to be a long, cold, cold winter. A quick break, right back after this. Hopefully we get Representative Rohrbach to come off the floor and talk to us. If not, we're still going to talk about the voucher thing. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A temporary payroll tax cut for 160 million American workers is set to expire by month's end unless Congress renews it. Instead of simply voting to renew it, House Republicans are attempting to trade their votes to extend it for other measures that would hurt federal workers. The GOP plan to extend the payroll tax cut would impose another year of pay freezes on federal workers. Those workers are already dealing with a two-year pay freeze. The Republicans also want to take even more from federal workers in exchange for extending the payroll tax cut. They want to hike the amount workers must give from their wages to pay for pensions and eliminate the Social Security supplement for workers who retire before age 62. The Federal Workers Alliance, a coalition of 22 federal unions, says that slashing the pay and benefits of one group of middle-class workers to extend a tax cut to another group of middle-class workers is the definition of insanity. The alliance says it's time Congress asked for more who can most afford it, instead of taking more money from workers. The unemployment benefits extension clock keeps ticking toward the December 31st cutoff as well, as House Republicans show no urgency in extending that lifeline for millions of jobless Americans. The Center for American Progress says without that extension, the economy would take about a $50 billion hit and would cost us another 275,000 jobs. The center says in 2010, unemployment benefits lifted 3.2 million Americans out of poverty. Massey Energy was at fault for that mine tragedy that took 29 lives in April of 2010. Jesse Russell reports.
Last week, the Labor Department released a nearly 1,000-page document regarding the Upper Big Branch mine explosion, which saw 29 mine workers lose their lives. The findings of the report show that the practices and policies of Massey Energy were the root cause of the April 5, 2010 tragedy. Even with the numerous pages of evidence against the corporation, the Justice Department announced on December 6 it would not pursue criminal charges against the mining company. The company will only pay $209 million, with only $47 million of that going to the families of the victims. The penalties will be paid by Alpha Natural Resources, the company that bought Massey Energy this year. However, the buck doesn't stop with the mining company. The Mine Safety and Health Administration plans to conduct an internal investigation into how the agency may have failed in its role. Meanwhile, even with 29 deaths and a history of violations under the company he once oversaw, former executive Don Blankenship incorporated McCoy Coal Group in Kentucky earlier this year. According to Bloomberg News, the company has yet to apply for any mining permits.
This newscast made possible in part by the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and by ULICO, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I've got a golden chance to make my way. And with a golden ticket, it's a golden day.
That's what they're trying to sell us, vouchers for everything, vouchers for health care, vouchers for education, vouchers as far as the eye can see. And in every instance, these vouchers fall short and are failures. And now, as I understand, last night they realized not getting the golden ticket bill passed, so they're going to throw out some amendments to try and save face to ram at least something through. Going to be interesting to see how that goes. I guess they're discussing that tonight. That's why I've asked James Rohrbach, chairman of the Democratic, chairman of the House Education Committee, to come talk to us. Representative Rohrbach, thanks for taking time for me.
Very glad to be with you.
You know, I look at this piece, this amendment that you threw out, this idea, all students can succeed. It's exactly what I've been saying for the longest time. Why not fix the handful of schools that are, quote-unquote, failing?
I would certainly agree with you. There are things we know we need to do. We need to make sure parents have good alternatives, and where a school is failing, try to make it better, and certainly make schools that are safer, kids can go and learn, address the broader societal problems, the additional supports some families need in order to be provide good environments for kids to learn. And we also need to focus in on subject areas by which kids are judged, like math and reading. Reading being especially important, because if you can't read, you can't progress in terms of education. So all these things are important, but then as well provide incentives that we get better teachers and principals in schools. So that's what my program does. We look at things that have that do work and make them more readily available to students.
And it sounds like common sense to me. Instead of throwing the baby out with the bathwater and privatizing, why not just fix the problems we've got? As I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, it appears that the voucher bill that was originally put forth doesn't look like it has support.
That's my understanding, that there's been a very a strenuous effort, particularly with the governor taking leadership to try and get votes for vouchers, and that seems to have fallen short. It's my understanding at this point that they haven't been able to get the necessary votes, and that it's unlikely we're going to do a voucher bill before we break for Christmas.
So you don't think this new thing that Majority Leader Turzai threw out, these amendments to Senate Bill 560, you don't think this is going to go anywhere?
Well, let me say that I think the voucher portion is not going to go anywhere. Now, the proposal that would expand charter schools and provide more tax credits has a chance of going forward. So I think you've got at least three different options on the table.
Okay.
And whereas the voucher proposal, the actual diversion of dollars designed for public education into private education might not happen, there is a possibility we'll get a different way of doing charter schools, perhaps getting a state office that would be able to authorize charter schools, even where local school districts did not want those charter schools, and then require those districts to pay for the charter schools. That's the process we're facing now.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I want to be able to have some control over charter schools. I want them to have to abide by the same rules and the same standards as any public school. Because if you're going to be grading one against the other, they should be apples and apples instead of apples and oranges.
And we should remember that charters are in fact public schools.
Right.
They're not. They are public schools, so they should be accountable in the same way that traditional public schools are.
Well, let me ask you this, because the voucher thing I think is a bad idea, but then you get into the other two things, which is the EITC, which, you know, part of me says, why do I need to go to business and say, please give us money and we'll give you tax credits to fund education, when we should just be saying, look, you need to pay your taxes.
Well, I would agree that, although I think that the willingness of business to provide the resources to education in exchange for tax credits does put more money into education. And my fundamental problem is that we divide the money so that most of that money goes to non-public schools. If we divided it in a more equitable way, I think I would have fewer problems with the tax credits. We put some of that money, at least a larger proportion of it, into public schools. We could do good things with the money for both public and non-public schools.
Let's talk about your provision, the All Students Can Succeed proposal you've put out. And I like what you said. Well, let's help 100% of the kids instead of just 3%, which is what the other bill says it will help. And you're saying it's going to cost about the same.
It's going to cost about the same, and it will do a better job. If you look at the premise upon which the other bill was designed, it says you have a certain number of failing violent schools. I think that's the way they characterize them. And so you look at the lowest 5%, and you say we're going to address those problems. The problem is you all always have 5% of schools at the bottom, so it's not a program that solves a problem and then moves on. There will always be 5% of the schools that are at a lower performing level. If 90% of the schools were doing an excellent job, or if schools were succeeding at 90% level of accomplishment, you would still have a lower part of that number, 5%, that were below 90, that were at 89, and this program would still be in place. What I'm looking at is a way to address the problems in schools, resolve those problems, and then move on.
How much of this voucher argument do you think is just blind faith ideology and the idea that we can privatize education and profitize it as opposed to true concern for students?
I think a lot of it is about the privatizing education and seeing education as a business in which there are profits to be gained. And that means that education and the welfare of individual kids gets lost somewhere in the debate.
Because as I understood the voucher bill, and what you're telling me is it doesn't have a chance of passing so far this year, which I think is a good thing, but as I understand it, there was no guarantee if I got this wonderful golden ticket, if I got my lottery prize, that I would be able to validate it anywhere, because the schools don't have to take me.
And that's the fatal flaw, is that if you come to the school on the first day of school, if your kid in one hand and your voucher in the other, they can still tell you no. And they certainly don't even provide... The other reality is that many of those schools won't even think about taking kids with special needs or kids that perhaps have some kind of difficulty. English is a second language. Those kind of special problems, they will generally not take those kids, and they will, in fact, not provide them with educational opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, this just seems like a bad idea all the way around. No matter how you slice it, how you dice it, it's a bad idea.
I would certainly agree with you. It is a bad idea.
And all it's going to do, especially in a year when we've cut, what, $960 million from education, I think all it's going to do is inflate the cost of education and provide us with a worse product at the end.
It's going to take more money away from public education and divert it to private education.
Let me change topics with you a bit here,
sure.
Representative Rohrbach. You know, one of the things that, you know, I know is going on, they're talking about the unemployment comp bill, the bonding portion of it. My part of it, I don't have a problem with the bonding portion of it. I think it's probably something we have to do to pay off the feds to save a little bit of money. My problem with it is the calculation and the solvency. I don't see anything being done to make sure that the system is actually working in the future to pay our costs. Had we back 25 years ago indexed it to where it was keeping up with where it was then, we wouldn't have the problems we have today.
I think you make an excellent point, and we're in fact debating that bill even as I speak to you, and I think that even when we do what we're doing, we're not necessarily going to address your concern.
So you're going to do the bonding thing, and what's going to happen to the solvency?
Well, the solvency, I've listened to the debate, we've been largely talking about the bonding. I'm not certain that we've really addressed the solvency issue at all, and that's something certainly that needs to be part of this discussion.
Because my concern is, and you know, I'm a working class guy, you know, I'm sure like you, I'm worried that when this fails, you pass this through and say, hey, we tried, it failed, now we've got to cut benefits, now we got to do like Florida did and cut the number of weeks, or like Michigan did and cut the number of weeks, or start slashing in half, or do some crazy arcane things like drug testing or GEDs or some other nonsense.
Well, that's certainly, when you don't have the money to pay for something, you find ways to reduce the obligation you have to meet. So that's a very real threat.
I know you got to hurry back to the floor, but let me ask you one last thing.
Sure.
Before you go. The state wine and spirit shops, another one of these issues that the Republicans thought that they were going to be able to ram through, kind of got a wrench into the wheel. Now we're talking about some bizarre hybrid idea of... it seems kind of convoluted to me.
I would agree with you. It's convoluted. It has not come to the fore to debate. And I think the reality, the proposal doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think that we need to look at the fact that, first of all, the state liquor stores do produce revenue for the state, but also they do exert a certain amount of control. Maybe people tend to argue for sort of a free market system tend not to understand some of the downside of the ability to just proliferate liquor stores everywhere with very little state supervision. Even now, in my district, we have problems with the failure to control alcohol consumption and the way alcohol is delivered to consumers. So So I'm concerned about anything that doesn't at least retain some degree of reasonable control over that process. And I don't see much in this proposal that's being authored by Representative Turzai that even addresses that issue.
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, when I was 15 growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, alcohol was right next to the Tic Tacs on the impulse aisle.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to buy alcohol at 15. Now that I'm a parent, I like the way things are. I don't want my kids to have access to that stuff until they're old enough and ready to handle the things that I wasn't able to, because I don't want them making the mistakes I made.
Sure. And reality is that too often we don't do a very good job of either educating young people or having a system that doesn't allow easy access.
Right. Last question, absolute last one. since the Republicans took over, how many jobs bills are out there? Because we're talking about privatizing schools, we're talking about privatizing state wine and spirit shops, we're talking about stealing people's right to vote, we're talking about all these things, Metcalf wanting to punish people for stealing wire, all kind of stuff. How many jobs bills are coming out?
We haven't really addressed jobs, which should be the primary concern of those of us in Harrisburg. We want to be about trying to revive our economy, providing economic opportunity to individuals who want to work and need to work in order to preserve their families and also to preserve their communities.
Yeah, I was thinking laser focus, jobs, jobs, jobs. Representative James Rohrbach, I appreciate the time. Great talking to you.
Great talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back with your thoughts. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
How small can a giant corporation get? I don't mean in size, but in spirit. Once again, America's biggest commercial empire, Walmart, is displaying its incredibly shriveled ethical center by whacking the already meager health care benefits that hundreds of thousands of workers count on. Just a couple of years ago, this $400 billion a year retailing colossus tried to hush critics of its Dickensian labor policies by ballyhooing a bare-bones health care plan for its associates. The insurance scheme had such high deductibles, however, that barely half of its employees bought into it. Now, even that benefit is being yanked from the 40% of Walmart's employees who are part-time workers. Also, insurance premiums and deductibles are being dramatically jacked up for thousands of full-time workers. For example, one full-timer, who's paid only $12,000 a year, will see her premium more than double to about $3,300 a year, a fourth of her income. I won't be able to afford the insurance, she says, and I really can't go without insurance because I have a heart problem. Top executives and the board of directors of this enormously profitable corporation also have a heart problem. They are taking advantage of America's raging unemployment crisis to stiff their workforce, since these low-wage, non-union employees desperately need the jobs and have no power to stand up to the corporation's greed. A Walmart PR flack says that decisions to whack the workers, quote, were not easy, but they strike a balance between managing costs and providing quality care and coverage. This is Jim Hightower saying, care and coverage for whom? For the top executives, of course. They get full health care coverage from the corporation. How's that for boosting morale? And for morality. For more information, go to farrespect.org/healthcare.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, because the gays are getting married, that is why people die and children go unfed. When I'm sad and alone and I'm wondering just why everything about my life is feeling like it's going down a toilet bowl. It hurts to know it's cause the gays.
Yeah, it's all because of the gays. Blame it all on the gays. And I don't think they'll mind. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. And speaking of the gays, San Francisco has become the first city in the United States to have a minimum wage above $10 an hour. Their minimum wage will jump from $9.92 an hour to $10.24, which means that the rest of us need to maybe start thinking about boosting our minimum wage. And you got to give the city credit. They want to make sure that folks are getting a little extra coin in their pocket. And understand, San Francisco is probably one of the highest priced cities to live in. And I don't know anybody who's going to live on 7 1/4. Good for them. Good for them. They went through a couple of stories of, you know, people saying, look, you know, I'm struggling. And this is one of those things that I had talked about right when Obama took office. Rewarding work. These are people who do some of the hardest jobs. I mean, you may think that working in a restaurant is not a hard job. I wouldn't want to do it, and I wouldn't want to do it for minimum wage.
We talk about minimum wage and labor for decades has fought for a living wage. Minimum wage right now, I mean, how can you live on 7 1/4, 7.35? Even though that's a great, actually, I'm sure it's the highest in the country, and they are to be congratulated. However, figures that I saw 2 years ago, Rick, for one person, were about $11.50. Now you take 2 more years of cost of living increases, it's probably about $12 an hour livable wage for one living wage for one individual, and that's just minimum standard. We should be fighting for living wage standards, not just minimum. Minimum wage means minimal for one reason. It's inadequate. It's hard to believe. It's been 5 years already that we got a raise. We got a raise. It's been 5 years since people in Pennsylvania are making maximum minimum wage at $7.35. Totally inadequate.
You know, I look at what Ron Johnson, the senator from Wisconsin, said the other day. He said, well, if you're making minimum wage, you're a bad worker. And I'm going, you know, I got to be honest. The woman who hands me my neat little bag of sausage McMuffin in the morning, that woman works her butt off, and I couldn't do the job. And it's amazing to me that we would not think that they're worth more. Yeah, 7 1/4, just not to me, not the not something you can raise a family on. But what's going on is, we've allowed that to happen by propping up. And there's, you know, there's, if you remember the Friedman, the great right-wing guru, Thomas, not Thomas, the other Friedman. What's his name? The old guy that died. I'll remember it. But Friedman, he was the guy who came up with the earned income tax credit. Said, look, okay, those people are going to pay minimum wage. The government has to prop those minimum wage workers up. And I'm in favor of that. And it's actually a stimulus for small businesses to hire people. You know, it's smart policy. But what ends up happening is then you get employers who take advantage of that. Say, well, fine, I'm just not going to pay anything but minimum wage because I know the government's going to subsidize it. So it's like, you know, at some point you've got to put a floor underneath folks. You know, I go back to one of the college professors I had. So she worked her way all the way through the University of Michigan, all the way to get her law degree. Working a minimum wage job, was able to afford an apartment. I wasn't a great one, as a crummy little apartment. I was able to pay her tuition and buy her books and walk out of there with a law degree and no debt. You try that today? Never going to happen. Got an email during the break, and of course you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Ron writes, you said that 1975 was the last time that the U.S. had a trade surplus. He says, isn't it a coincidence? The first ever bank bailout, Franklin National, $1.7 billion, took place in 1975. Kind of an interesting coincidence. I'm going to have to look into that a little bit, Ron. I appreciate it. Thanks so much for the email. A new study came out. The folks over at Good Jobs First, they have come out with their study, Money for Something, Job Creation and Job Quality Standards in State Economic Development Subsidy Programs. They're looking at the 51 state report card. And Pennsylvania got a D, basically saying, we're not doing such a great job. And they looked at the fact that of the 238 things that they looked at, nearly all the programs, 222, had some type of performance rating, but only 135 of them related to job creation or job retention or training with a certain number of workers. It wasn't worker-centric. It was business-centric. How much of the profit, how much of the tax revenue, it really wasn't, we're not really thinking about that so much. In fact, 98 of the programs had job-related standards that required them to keep jobs that remained in existence. I had to do it for a minimum amount of time. This is kind of stuff that I've been talking about with these economic development funds. You get these companies who we give subsidies to say, oh, please come. Come and build your business here and come and employ our people. And then they don't employ anybody. We give them a bunch of subsidies. They bring their workers with them. Sure, they build the building, but that's a short-term influx. But now you got more people. So you've created no new jobs, and you gave them tax abatements away, and you gave them subsidies, and you gave, and you got nothing back. And then when it runs out, they go, hey, next, and then that's where they go. This is kind of what this report is showing out. Look, if we're giving out money, we should be saying you need to tie that money to job creation. You've got to create X amount of jobs in this area. You've got to be here X amount of time, and it's got to be agreed to. So that they say, well, the subsidies are done, we're gone too. And it's got to be in a situation where it's creating good jobs. You know, Cabela's is one of those companies that there was a study done about them not too long ago where, you know, they're basically subsidy whores. They run around and they suck up and gobble up subsidies and never really, it never breaks even for the communities. And I'm sure there's a little development around them. I mean, you look at the one down the road here. There's development around that. But how much money did it cost the area to get that put in? You know, how much did it cost the local tax base? And as I've been saying for the longest time, this beggar thy neighbor economic development is killing us globally. We don't think as a nation when it comes to job creation. We don't think as a nation when it comes to manufacturing or energy or any of that. We think as, you know, individual little countries who compete against each other before we compete against anybody else. At some point, we got to change that mentality. And I get the whole, the states are the laboratories and we create stuff in the states. We're in a global environment like none other. We've always been in a global environment, but not like this. And what's going on is we're beating the tar out of each other, stealing from each other, subsidizing these big multinationals who say, well, if you don't give it to us to keep it here, we're going to take it over to China. And now that China's created this $300 billion sovereignty wealth fund whose sole purpose is to buy us, it should be a wake-up call to say maybe we need some smart policy, national policy. Maybe instead of focusing at each other and going, no, I want my tax cut, or no, I won't. Maybe we should go on, how do we protect ourselves from the Chinese? How do we look across the river, the ocean over there and go, they're killing us? And not with guns or bullets. They're buying us piece by piece by piece. It's insane, Jake.
Well, you mentioned we should be looking to protect ourselves from China. We should be looking to protect ourselves from the greed of the multinationals. And this is a serious question. How would you address that issue of corporations basically strong-arming one state against the other?
The Constitution gives the U.S. Congress the ability to regulate commerce. I say the Fed step in and stop that type of economic development. If you steal from one state, you want to bring jobs to your state, and you steal it with subsidies, you'll get money subtracted from highway transfer, highway funds or some other funds. There's got to be a mechanism to stop these states who are allowing these big companies to hold them hostage. Look, the states are only doing what they have to do. It's these big companies who now have them hostage. You need to have a bigger entity, which is why you need a stronger federal government, to step in and say, we're not going to let you do it, and we're going to put a stop to it.
You'd stop it by being punitive. I guess I would imagine that if you passed a law which says it's illegal, I'm sure they, under the Commerce Clause, they would take that to court.
Yeah,
I'm not so sure you could win that.
You can't win that if it's illegal. There has to be a disincentive. There's got to be a stick. They want the carrot. They want the tax subsidy. They want these things. You've got to say to these states, look, you go down that route, you're going to lose out on it. And that's how I would do it. And I think it would be perfectly within their ability under the Commerce Clause to regulate interstate commerce. But on a bigger scale, you know, you got to be looking at these companies where, you know, it used to be, you know, what's good for General Motors was good for the country. General Motors is a global corporation. They think no more about this country than any other. Their bottom line is how do we feed the shareholders? How do we make sure the wealth class is taken care of? And the wealth class, they don't care whether the money comes from here or Saipan or Ubi Gooby or who cares. All they care about is I got cash in my pocket. There's money in my portfolio. And that's the downfall. You know, I go back to the McCain slogan, country first. Start thinking in those terms. And companies that go overseas and build plants and then want to send their product back here, you treat as a foreign company. You stop allowing companies to stockpile cash overseas and not pay taxes here. You stop that. Because you know what happens. It builds up, it builds up, it builds up. And then they say, oh, gee, we could create jobs if you let us bring that money back. Let us repatriate all that money. And they never create any jobs with it. They divvy it up amongst themselves. Hey, party time. More hookers and blow. You'll get the reference of that. You know, if you remember a couple years ago when Bill Schuster, congressman, was out in Denver for the Democratic National Convention. He went to the bar there, and the band was Hookers and Blow. Just saying the name of the band. What do you think about Chicago being a state of its own? What do you think of the idea of the city of Chicago saying, you know what, screw you guys, or Philadelphia saying, screw you, Pennsylvania, we're going to be the state of Philadelphia?
Never thought about it.
When we come back, we're going to think about it. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
For 75 years, AFSCME has protected basic workers' rights. A living wage, health benefits, safe working conditions, these aren't privileges to be taken away, they're rights to be protected. This is Dave Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. Public services and workers' rights are under attack like never before. But the Main Street movement is pulling together. Nurses, firefighters, cops, teachers, students, and neighbors. Ordinary Americans are fighting back and making history. From victories in Wisconsin, Ohio, and right here in Pennsylvania, AFSCME was there. AFSCME will always be there. Coming after workers and their unions, it's a shameful agenda for Wall Street politicians, but AFSCME's been in this fight for 75 years. We're not about to stop now. Join the Main Street movement at AFSCME13.org. And from all of us at AFSCME, happy holidays.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. 2561.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell are we fighting for? Just surrender and it won't hurt at all. Just got time to say your prayer. While you're waiting for a hammer
call. And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. 7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So the question before the break was, should Chicago be allowed to be the 51st state? You got a couple of representatives, Republican representatives, from the lowlands in Illinois. You gotta love this. Who basically said, look, you know, once you get outside of Chicago, there are values. Once you get outside of there, there's, you know, there are people who have different ideas. And, you know, Chicago, they're the ones who are, you know, they're bringing us down. So, these two Republicans have decided that they want to, well, they want to split Chicago off from the rest of the state, make it its own state, so you could have your conservative state of Illinois. In fact, they said it would be run like Indiana. So you tell them to get lost, they would have their conservative paradise. So no more of that overly liberal, tax-hungry metropolis. No more of them. We want to be like Indiana. And I'm going, really? You want to be like Indiana? It's kind of like Pennsylvania wanting to be like Texas. Doesn't make an awful lot of sense. But what I find interesting, the article goes into, and this is really, well, the reason I brought this up is it's really this huge disconnect between these God-fearing Christian values people and people who actually work for a living. And I'm just going to read from the article. I think they put it the best. The Chicago area last year generated 81.6% of the $652 billion in gross state product. Almost 82% of the money that was generated in the state of Illinois, Chicago was the place where it happened. According to Larry Michal, president of the Chicago-based Civics Federation, a nonpartisan think tank, and they specialize in tax policy. In 2009, $3.5 billion of some 40% of the $8.7 billion collected by the state in income tax, Cook County, which is where they want to put off. So you're looking at all of this money. The state was also, they were also responsible for 36% or 2.2% of the sales tax. So you think of the sales tax, you think of the income tax, you think of the gross product. Chicago is paying for the rest of the state. Everything that goes on in Chicago is paying for everybody else. And this is kind of, again, it is so clear that in all these areas where you have these Republicans who are talking about, we need freedom and we need liberty, they're talking about you and me paying for them to get what they want because we're already paying for them. If you've looked at the tax dollars that go into Washington and where they go out to, if I'm Massachusetts, I'm thinking about leaving the nation as a whole because, you know, Massachusetts, New York, Connecticut, those states, for every dollar they send in, they get 63, 70 cents back. Places like Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Arkansas, every dollar they send to the federal government, they get a buck and a half back. Who's the dumb one here? And if I'm Chicago, I take these two Republicans up on it. Go, yep, we'll be happy to cut off the toothless, ignorant part of the state. Wouldn't you? I mean, if you're Philadelphia, don't you go, you know what? I'm tired of carrying Center County. I'm tired of carrying the middle of the state. Let that part go.
You realize in Pennsylvania, you know, there have been people in the state legislature for decades using that exact same argument against Philadelphia. I've heard it time and time and time again.
But not against Philadelphia. Understand, these big cities, that's where the money is generated. That's where the things happen.
I realize that, and the numbers say you're exactly right. But they have a political agenda, and it's easy. Well, there's two things when they say that. First of all, I think they're serious about separating, but beyond that, it's a good talking point to make them look good in the eyes of the conservatives. Blame Philadelphia. Philadelphia's sucking up all of the money. Philadelphia is the cause of most of the crime. Philadelphia is just making us pay more, which isn't true. The reverse of that is there's more money that comes out of Philadelphia than any other section of the state by far.
And again, it's this disconnect because they don't, there's nothing going on upstairs on this. You know, but that's what the numbers bear out, and it's pretty simple there. You know, I'm not in favor of splitting things up, you know, because then you get into the whole North-South argument. Do we then split into different countries? Because you could make the argument there's six different countries here. You know, the Northeast, you know, the South, the Southwest, the Northwest, the West, and the Midwest there. You could easily split this country up into six nations, and then we'd be fighting each other like you're seeing in the Middle East. One of the great things that we've been able to accomplish in this country is that we haven't sent our National Guards after each other. I don't know. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. I got Ron on line one. How are you doing tonight, Ron?
I'm okay, Rick. How about you?
Oh, not too bad. What do you think? Do we send the city of Chicago off to its own state?
Bye.
I guess not.
I think a city of Chicago would be okay. I think it's the rest of the people in Illinois that are going to suffer, obviously.
Absolutely. What else you got on your mind?
Well, I kind of, the comment about the Republicans said it would be run like Indiana. I keep being haunted by the thought that Indiana took a interstate highway and leased it to a foreign entity.
Yep.
I'm a little upset with that. You know, you and I built a damn thing, and they want to give profit to some foreign country.
We were talking about doing it here with our turnpike, Ron.
Understood. And where did they, you know, they talk about doing with all the airports. Under Bush, they wanted to do with the ocean ports, the ports of entry.
Yep. And now you look at the Chinese have set up this $300 billion wealth sovereignty fund. What else are they going to buy up of ours?
Lord knows. I wanted to go make a comment about that idea that flatlanders in Illinois would want to run their state like Indiana.
Yeah. That's a great idea, don't you think?
You know, I'm in the heart of central Pennsylvania, but either Philadelphia or Pittsburgh cuts us loose, we're going to starve.
And, you know, the sad thing is I don't think most people realize that. You know, I have friends here in the center part of the state, and they're demonizing Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, especially Philadelphia. I make the same argument. Look, you know, that's what's generating the revenue. That's what's paying the, you know, all of the subsidies that come to the center of the state. And you can say what you want about Rendell. I'm not a huge fan, but you can say what you want about him. He took care of every county in this state.
I agree with that. I met the man here in Clinton County a couple of times. You know, because he went to every county. He did what he could do. Corbett would be well advised not to come here.
Why? Well, what's wrong with Corbett?
Well, you know, we wouldn't need Philadelphia's money so much if we could tax some of Marcellus stuff they're taking out of our heartlands here.
I hear you on that, man. And it's a shame what's going on. We were at an awards ceremony over the weekend, and we met a woman from Dimmock, and she was telling us about her water supply and what went on. And I'm going, man, this is just the tip of the iceberg.
I saw a guy on the PCN Talkback show mentioning a road sign up in Towanda. It said Chesapeake Energy spent X number of dollars rebuilding this highway.
Nice.
And he thought that was great. And I thought, you know, there's just no mention of the fact that they spent how much destroying the highway.
It's all about advertising.
Well, you know, it's their incredible track that could bust these things up. They wouldn't need fixed quite so fast.
Excellent point. Excellent point. And, you know, again, we need to hold their feet to the fire. I mean, there's only a small amount of people, you know, pointing this stuff out, and we need to support them.
Okay, well, listen, thanks for taking the call, Rick. You take care, and good luck.
Anytime, Ron. Appreciate the call. Call anytime.
Bye-bye.
No, you know, I look at this, and again, you know, the reality, you know, you're looking at big signs on the road saying, brought to you by this corporation. Get ready for that. Because corporate America is great at tooting their horn and touting what they do. They're fantastic at it. You know, I still go back to Walmart sending $8 million of water down during Hurricane Katrina and spending something like $18 million to tell us that they did it. Right back after this with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Stick around.
Right. The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A temporary payroll tax cut for 160 million American workers is set to expire by month's end unless Congress renews it. Instead of simply voting to renew it, House Republicans are attempting to trade their votes to extend it for other measures that would hurt federal workers. The GOP plan to extend the payroll tax cut would impose another year of pay freezes on federal workers. Those workers are already dealing with a two-year pay freeze. The Republicans also want to take even more from federal workers in exchange for extending the payroll tax cut. They want to hike the amount workers must give from their wages to pay for pensions and eliminate the Social Security supplement for workers who retire before age 62. The Federal Workers Alliance, a coalition of 22 federal unions, says that slashing the pay and benefits of one group of middle-class workers to extend a tax cut to another group of middle-class workers is the definition of insanity. The alliance says it's time Congress asked for more who can most afford it instead of taking more money from workers. The unemployment benefits extension clock keeps ticking toward the December 31st cutoff as well, as House Republicans show no urgency in extending that lifeline for millions of jobless Americans. The Center for American Progress says without that extension, the economy would take about a $50 billion hit and would cost us another 275,000 jobs. The center says in 2010, unemployment benefits lifted 3.2 million Americans out of poverty. Massey Energy was at fault for that mine tragedy that took 29 lives in April of 2010. Jesse Russell reports.
Last week, the Labor Department released a nearly 1,000-page document regarding the Upper Big Branch mine explosion, which saw 29 mine workers lose their lives. The findings of the report show that the practices and policies of Massey Energy were the root cause of the April 5, 2010 tragedy. Even with the numerous pages of evidence against the corporation, the Justice Department announced on December 6 it would not pursue criminal charges against the mining company. The company will only pay $209 million, with only $47 million of that going to the families of the victims. The penalties will be paid by Alpha Natural Resources, the company that bought Massey Energy this year. However, the buck doesn't stop with the mining company. The Mine Safety and Health Administration plans to conduct an internal investigation into how the agency may have failed in its role. Meanwhile, even with 29 deaths and a history of violations under the company he once oversaw, former executive Don Blankenship incorporated McCoy Coal Group in Kentucky earlier this year. According to Bloomberg News, the company has yet to apply for any mining permits.
This newscast made possible in part by the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and by ULICO, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. As I understand it, things over at the Capitol are heated. There's some wild stuff going on. Our guest Irwin Aronson going to be a little bit late as they're still debating all of the, you know, the UC bill, the voucher bill, the privatization, all of the hateful, nasty, well, all the Republican bills that they thought they were going to be able to steamroll through. Turns out Pennsylvania may have a handful of sane, rational Republicans left, maybe just a few, that were able to hold this real ugliness back. And thank goodness, because there is nothing good being proposed here. Remember what they said. Jobs. Laser-like focus. Jobs, jobs, jobs. They haven't come up. I have seen nothing come out of this state house that has to do with anything having to do with jobs. I guess the big piece, the big victory for the Republicans are that they passed through the abortion thing. So that when they set up the exchanges under the Affordable Care Act, they say that no tax dollars are going to go for abortion. Big victory, they're going to have a big signing ceremony. So Corbett can at least claim victory on something. Now, the other stuff, all of the privatization, all of the hocking off of state assets, all of the selling of our souls, fortunately, well, someone's tapping on the brakes. Not slamming on, just kind of tapping on them. And we're putting up a good fight. That's why I've been saying all along, should be calling early and often. Bill O'Reilly had Alan Combs on, and I like Alan Combs. I've met him a couple of times. Seems like a decent guy. And they're talking about government. Saying, well, government shouldn't be involved in things. O'Reilly said, I don't want government in healthcare. Government's bad. You know, that whole government bad frame. So Combs jumps in. He goes, you know, since you don't think and they can run anything, do you think they can run the military? And O'Reilly really had a very ignorant, uninformed revision. I'm trying to think of the right word. Just completely wrong idea. O'Reilly replied to the question, can the government run the military, by saying they can't run the military because the military is controlled, not civilian. I don't know what that means, but that's what he said. He said, that's government. You know, Combs said, that's government run. It's the government doing it. And O'Reilly says, no, no. The Pentagon calls the shot. And he's like, hello? Hello? That's government. And he's going, no, no, that's wrong. O'Reilly says, wrong, wrong, wrong. The Pentagon calls the shots on how the military operates, and the Pentagon is military people. And Combs goes, that's the government. It's the government. It's still the government. The government hired these people. The government's doing this. And O'Reilly's, no, no. They work for and the government running the two different things. And I'm going, really working for the government and the government doing it are two different things? Explain that to me. And it's, you know, the more I listen to the right try and explain their hatred of government when they're cornered, the more I'm confused at where they're getting all this from. Because, you know, it's a good talking point. Government bad. Private for-profit interest, good. You could put that almost on a bumper sticker. Government bad. Private good. You know, it sounds like a caveman thing. But in practice, government does a lot of very good things, especially when you have transparency and oversight and you have a clear message where you don't have a party trying to poison pill it at every single turn. You look at Medicare. Look at how many times Republicans have tried to destroy Medicare. Look at how much they've tried to poison pill it. That prescription drug bill was designed to do nothing but tear Medicare down. That was the point of it. And, of course, pay off their campaign donors. And they had a couple of, you know, Democrats who, you know, hey, okay, that sounds a good idea. But for the most part, if government has a clear mandate where this is your job, without one party or the other, usually the Republicans when it comes to government, trying to destroy their what they're doing or underfund them or starve them out, they do a good job. So I find it curious that, you know, the Republicans, especially the O'Reillys, put the military up on this pedestal and then don't realize that, you know, the military people have health care, they have pensions, they have reasonable living wages, they have vacation time, they have sick time, they've got all kinds of stuff. But we can't do that in the private sector because that's private. Leave private alone. Don't want that socialist stuff in the private sector. Leave that socialist stuff to the government-run military. Isn't that what they're kind of saying? So what do you think? Do we bring back debtors' prisons? Do we bring them back? Evidently, and you know, and I've been talking about this for a while, the fact that we're going to eventually be back in the days of putting people in prison for not paying their bills. Because you lost your job, you couldn't pay your light bill, sorry, you're going to have to work it off in the workhouse. Turns out, I didn't realize it, but in a third of the states in this country, you can be put in jail for not paying your bills. Even though debtors' prisons have been banned by a number of constitutions, they still lock people up. I look at Illinois and the example that they use, this woman, Robin Sanders, who's driving down the road, who's driving along, you know, again, doesn't have a real big, good job. The muffler's, and she gets pulled over. Cop pulls her over, says, you got a muffler, we're going to have to cite you for that. He goes, oh, hey, by the way, when we ran your driver's license, there's a warrant for your arrest. you didn't pay a medical bill, and the collection agency filed a lawsuit, and you didn't show up to court, you're going to jail for a $730 medical bill. Now, I was under the impression that some due diligence had to happen. Before they could drag you into court, they had to notify you, which she claims they didn't. She didn't know she was being pursued by a collection agency, which makes me think, did the collection agency do its job? Or did they just go, because I've had this happen to me, and I empathize. They just go and say, Matt, we made a phone call, he didn't answer, we're sending it right to his credit rating, we're gonna ruin this guy. Did they do that? And then when the court calls a hearing, don't they have to notify both people? Isn't there a subpoena process? Isn't there a, you have to be delivered something? So here, they have to document that you knew? Evidently not in Illinois, because they locked her up. And you look at these different states that are doing this. I mean, think of all the people who are being foreclosed on. Are all those people going to be locked up? Think of all the free labor. Now, think of this from the Republican standpoint. Think of Alabama, who, you know, they can't get the immigrants to come because they passed that insane law. So now they want to get prisoners to pick their crops. Think of Georgia, where they don't want to pay firemen, so they just want to use prisoners to come out and put out fires. Think of all the things we could do. How many people's mortgages are underwater? What, they say 9 million immediately? Is that about the number?
It's about right.
So you got about 9 million people who right now, we could just lock up right now for not paying their bills. And then you could put them to work. Cheap. I think that there is an economic development plan. Maybe we should pursue that. What do you think?
Well, that goes right along with the idea of reinstituting poorhouses. If you want to take away, you know, you want to eliminate and privatize Social Security, we can go back to the good old days. It wasn't that long ago we had poorhouses when people retired or couldn't work anymore, and if their family couldn't take care of them, that's where you went to die. There's similarities to that, the good old days.
Nice.
Things that we thought were long since gone. Of course, we thought that child labor was a thing of the past, apparently, for some Republicans, including Newt. He's revisiting that horror. Amazing. It's amazing that a man running for president would even bring that subject up.
Nice. And you look at Illinois. Evidently, judges there have signed off on more than 5,000 warrants to arrest people and throw them in jail for not paying their bill.
It would be interesting. $700 bill, you said, or, you know, $700, $800. I wonder how long she'd have to serve for that.
Well, when I was a younger man, I think they used to say charge you 30. You could work off 30 bucks a day in the workhouse, so 30 bucks a day.
Wow, she'll be there a while.
Free, a lot of free labor. So good stuff. Good, good, good. I mean, at least we've got an economic development plan.
Almost a month.
They're thinking. At least they're thinking.
Wow.
I mean, the Republicans aren't creating jobs. I mean, look what they're doing across the street. Nothing that they're doing here in Harrisburg is going to create a job. What it's going to do is it's going to cost you and me, the taxpayers, a whole boatload more money. That's what it's intended to do.
Well, here's another unintended consequence. If she can't get work release, she'll lose her job.
And then we can keep her longer because she won't pay the next bill. See how this works? It's a good, good, solid policy. That's what we should be doing. And then we can take her unemployment away because, you know, we'll find a reason for that. And if you look at yesterday we talked about the big Republican bill, we're going to restore jobs and cut taxes and we're going to do something, Bill. No. What we're going to do is we're going to cost more people. 3.3 million people are going to lose their unemployment insurance thanks to the Republicans ramming through their... And again, I don't know why people don't see this. To me, it's blatantly obvious that you can call it whatever you want. You can come up with it's the Middle Class Tax Relief and Job Creation Act. See, we're going to create jobs and cut taxes. When in it, all it's going to do is take unemployment away and give handouts to corporations, deregulate, and, of course, give them one of their wet dreams. I'm trying to figure out, you know, how do you not see that? You know, we talked about it yesterday, how much this bill, if it passes, and it's not going to, the Senate's not going to bring it through, but these people are going to take us to the brink. Understand, 3 days, you know, Friday, we're shutting down. They're already talking about contingency plans. Understand, December 31st, unemployment, that if you're on an extension, that's it. If they don't pass something. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. And they're talking in the town square. And they're talking, they're shouting. And they're talking everywhere. They're talking never stops. But all their words are whispering. Won't make you go away. And they close the pressure down. And nothing left to say.
You're a proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
How small can a giant corporation get? I don't mean in size, but in spirit. Once again, America's biggest commercial empire, Walmart, is displaying its incredibly shriveled ethical center by whacking the already meager healthcare benefits that hundreds of thousands of workers count on. Just a couple of years ago, this $400 billion a year retailing colossus tried to hush critics of its Dickensian labor policies by ballyhooing a bare-bones health care plan for its associates. The insurance scheme had such high deductibles, however, that barely half of its employees bought into it. Now, even that benefit is being yanked from the 40% of Walmart's employees who are part-time workers. Also, insurance premiums and deductibles are being dramatically jacked up for thousands of full-time workers. For example, one full-timer, who's paid only $12,000 a year, will see her premium more than double to about $3,300 a year, a fourth of her income. I won't be able to afford the insurance, she says, and I really can't go without insurance because I have a heart problem. Top executives and the board of directors of this enormously profitable corporation also have a heart problem. They are taking advantage of America's raging unemployment crisis to stiff their workforce. Since these low-wage, non-union employees desperately need the jobs and have no power to stand up to the corporation's greed. A Walmart PR flack says that decisions to whack the workers, quote, were not easy, but they strike a balance between managing costs and providing quality care and coverage. This is Jim Hightower saying, care and coverage for whom? For the top executives, of course. They get full health care coverage from the corporation. How's that for boosting morale? And for morality? For more information, go to farrespect.org/healthcare.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thoughts are a reality. The Rick Smith Show. You are the witness of change in the counteract. We
gotta take the power back. And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast right there. If you've got a smartphone, you can get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. So Time Magazine has named their Person of the Year for 2011. And you may go, hey, well, probably some celebrity. No, they've actually named the protester as the Person of the Year because, as you've seen across the globe, people are taking to the streets. In Tanzania, Moscow, Wall Street, all across Oakland, shutting down the ports. People saying, you know what? We've got power in numbers. And this is scaring the hell out of the investor class. Because if we get that taste, and this is why I've been so in favor of this, if people get the taste of shutting things down and saying nothing until our demands are met in this country, maybe we start getting some of our demands met. Maybe, just maybe. Some of the other people on the list, some of the runner-ups, Admiral William McGraven, head of the Joint Special Operations Command, Chinese dissident artist Aoi Weiwei, and Kate Middleton. Why her? I have no idea. And how you make, all she did was get married. And that makes you a Person of the Year. Jeez, tells you how silly we are sometimes. But good on that, the protester. So good. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Ike on line one. How you doing tonight, Ike?
Hey, buddy. Yeah, it's a good example that, for our discussion last night, you know, everybody's going to have to get up to the plate, and we're all going to have to get together, and we're going to have to start shutting these people down around the globe. They want to push their corporatism and feed off the know, the bones of the poor and, you know, grind everybody underneath their jackboot. Well, we just got to stand up. That's all there is to it.
Yeah, right there with you. So what's on your mind tonight?
I mean, go ahead.
No, what's on your mind?
Well, you know, I'm just saying there's hope. You know, I know things look dismal, you know, but the pendulum on that clock has swung a long way in one direction. And, you know, I think it's coming back the other way. I think we're on the cusp of seeing some real action, particularly if what I keep hearing through Wall Street or the Occupy Charleston people here and elsewhere, that Anonymous is stirring in the background, and evidently they've got some stuff on some people that they're going to release that's really going to blow the lid off of, I don't know, some pretty big-time stuff.
Good. Again, as I've always said, I'm in favor of transparency. I'm in favor of accountability, open sunshine, all of that stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, it's definitely going to take everybody doing their part, you know, and so far, I don't know, as far as Latin America goes, down south, I'm not exactly sure if they've gotten into the movement or not, but God knows, you know, they're just as oppressed as any people on the planet. And I hope to see the movement spread that way. But, like I said, you know, you got to be hopeful. You know, if you look around the globe, it's really catching fire and people are finally saying enough's enough.
Yeah, and until we can reach across borders, and this is something labor has tried to do with some international, agreements. The steel workers have done a real nice job of it. You know, until you can follow these multinationals around the globe and unionize them wherever they go and make sure the standards are high enough to where people in those countries aren't exploited, nothing changes. Until you can follow the money and stop the exploitation, nothing changes. But I'm hopeful that you're right. We are seeing across the globe an uprising of people saying, you know what, you may have the gun, you may have the surveillance, you may have the drones to follow us, but we got the numbers, we got the boots in the streets. We've out-procreated your technology.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's what infuriated me so bad about the NAFTA agreement. Because I know how hard that, after it was negotiated underneath the Republican George Bush, for the most part, Clinton tried to get in there and his team, and they tried to bring in worker protection, right to unionize, minimum wage, and a lot of other things. And, they were blocked every time they turn around. And as a matter of fact, I haven't delved into it yet, but, those other two new trade agreements, they just rushed through the Congress. I wonder what kind of bad news is coming out of that move.
There's tons of bad news there. There's some, again, some more weak provisions, but, you know, the big ones being the 65% foreign content. I mean, you're only requiring 35% domestic content, which means, you know, a friend of ours sent us an article and said, look, what's going on in South Korea right now is they're farming work out to the north, paying 25 cents an hour, and then that's part of the 65% domestic, the 65% content that can be foreign. So we're actually buying things from the North Koreans because of this agreement, and there's nothing that I understand in it that precludes that from happening.
Yeah, and I got slammed. I went and bought some fans last summer, and I looked for the Made in USA label, and I actually called the company after I bought them. It was Lasco Fans. And as it turns out, a lot of the miscellaneous parts were made here, but the motor, the main content of the whole machine was made in China, but yet it had Made in America on it.
The other question that we have is what is Made in America? You know, what's that definition? I mean, they've been able to, to sew a label on things and say, we did it here. You can't always believe the labeling either, which is a problem of our government.
Yeah, no doubt. But, I'm hopeful. You know, I'm looking forward to a new year, and I'm looking for, you know, I'm looking for things to continue to grind. And, you know, they just got to know they're dancing on the head of a pin, and it's hard to get us to stand up together. But I'll tell you what, once we do, we're hell to put back down. And they got to know what they got to realize they're playing with fire.
Yep.
And, you know, I don't see how they can think that their gated communities or their bodyguards or any of the rest of it's going to protect them if the hell really does break loose.
No, it's just like that fence they want to put on the border. You can build a 30-foot fence, and I'll show you a 31-foot ladder or a big shovel.
Yeah, and, you know, that's all. That's, you know, that whole that whole deal there, it still comes down to interior enforcement and, you know, following the rules and regulations. But
and I'm in favor of building a fence.
Well, I've got a big heart myself, brother, but all I can tell you is I know we've given a hell of a lot of help over the years to down south, you know, to propping up their peso, to doing all kinds of things for them folks down there one way or the other, and I know about the IMF, and I know the kind of games that go on.
Okay, as long as you know about the IMF, because you can't say we propped up their peso when we're the ones who convinced them to take the IMF loan that actually crashed their peso. So, okay, just so we're on the same page.
Well, I'll put it to you this way. You know, strictly from a human being standpoint, I want to see everybody with enough food, a roof over their head, you know, and their bills paid and a little extra to be able to do something with it. But, you know, in reality, you got to fight for it. And, you know, you can't just sit back and make excuses and run away from it. You have to stand up to it. And that's what I'm hoping this next year is bringing, brother.
That's what I'm hoping. Ike, I appreciate it, and I wish you the best in the new year as well.
Yes, sir. Y'all have a good night.
You too. Thanks so much. Well, you knew this was coming, and I've been saying for the longest time here in Pennsylvania when they passed the big texting ban, you knew it was coming. Now the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, they are recommended a nationwide ban on drivers' use of any personal electronic devices. I wonder if that's the radio in your car. Are we going to start pulling radios out now? As I've been saying for the longest time, if we're going to take, you know, the phone, you know, the handset free thing, I could take that away from you. I say if distractions are a problem, and for some truly it is, we take children out, we take passengers out, we most certainly take coffee out. Coffee's a bad thing. Ask the woman who burnt her, you know what, on the spilled coffee. We take little video games. We take all that stuff out of the car, and we put in the driver's seat just windows, and it's secluded from the rest of the car. There's no sound. There's nothing. It's just you and your little cube. Maybe that's the way we have to go. Personally, I think the texting ban was a bad idea. I think, you know, at the end of it, there are laws on the books. We don't need more of them. I've gone through this a number of times. And they use a handful of accidents. It's like anything. I can come up with a justification to take anything away from you. I'm keeping you safe. I can come up with a justification. I can find rationale for anything. The question is when does it stop? And that was my problem with the texting ban. Yeah, a couple of kids driving down the road texting, and they shouldn't have been because, one, they're bad texters, and, two, they're really bad drivers. They end up killing themselves. Yeah, that happens. In fact, you know how many times I've had people just pull out in front of me because, oh, they were just daydreaming. Can we outlaw daydreaming? No. So, again, I go back to this thing. You keep giving things up. At what point does it stop? So if we're going to continue to go down this path, I say let's just make it one fell swoop. No distractions, no kids, no people, nothing, no newspapers. And when I was driving a truck, I have seen people doing absolutely everything you can possibly imagine while driving a car. Everything. And let your mind run for a little bit, and I'll say yes. There was the guy who was drinking his coffee, reading the newspaper across the steering wheel, driving with his knees at 65 miles an hour. That, can we outlaw that too? Probably should. Can we outlaw the woman who had the car on cruise control, holding it with one hand, reaching in the back of the minivan, smacking the kid, going all over three lanes? Can we outlaw that? Can we put that in the bill? How about the guy who, you know, it's late. I'm driving down Interstate 91 up there in Connecticut. It's dark out. I'm driving. This car pulls up next to me. I'm in the big truck. I'm looking down. I see flickering lights. There are no street lights at this part of the road. And he's just, you know, he's kind of all over the road, next to me, behind me. We come to an area where it's lit. And there he is with no pants on. And a little DVD player playing a XXX movie, and he is doing what individuals do while watching those type of things, while driving. Can we outlaw that? So if you want to talk about banning things. I can give you thousands of things. And that's just the tip of it. That's just the tip of the things that are going on that road. So that's my knock on this. Look, do I want to be killed by some idiot who can't text and drive or can't chew bubble gum and drive at the same time? No. But there are already laws for this. You take their driver's license away. Do we need more special laws? No. We got enough of them. And this is where I agree with the libertarians. We're complicating things. Simply, if you're driving all over the road, that's reckless driving. Last time I checked, that was 6 points. You get two of those, you don't drive again. It's good. That's it. Done. Your insurance rates go through the roof. Do we need more? I don't think so. I know you, Jake. I know you think it's a good idea. I don't.
Within reason. I guess my question is, would you advocate, if you have to text to pull off to the side of the road, at least do that?
It depends on the situation. Everything is situational, in my opinion. If you're having a full conversation texting while driving, you should be smacked. That's simple. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show.
For 75 years, AFSCME has protected basic workers' rights. A living wage, health benefits, safe working conditions. These aren't privileges to be taken away. They're rights to be protected. This is Dave Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. Public services and workers' rights are under attack like never before. But the Main Street movement is pulling together. Nurses, firefighters, cops, teachers, students, and neighbors. Ordinary Americans are fighting back and making history. From victories in Wisconsin, Ohio, and right here in Pennsylvania, AFSCME was there. AFSCME will always be there. Coming after workers and their unions, it's a shameful agenda for Wall Street politicians, but AFSCME's been in this fight for 75 years. We're not about to stop now. Join the Main Street movement at AFSCME13.org.
Dear John Bank, I am so sorry it has to be this way, but there's just no choice. I wish circumstances were different, but I can't hide my feelings any longer. I'm in love with another, and you just don't compare. I got tired of you taking advantage of me, charging me higher and higher fees, and raising rates behind my back. I did love you so, but now we have to break up. It's hard, but the right thing for me. I'm with PSECU now, and this credit union treats me right. That's all I ever asked for, to be somewhere I belong.
If you're ready to break up with your bank and take back what's yours, we're ready to help. Call, click, or come in. You can join. Go to PSECU.com/be free and see where you belong.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. So as we speak, over in the state capitol, they are arguing, debating, trying to ram through their legislation to create the golden ticket for vouchers. They're trying to privatize the state wine and spirit shops, trying to screw unemployed workers on the unemployment comp bill. So much going on here in the 11th hour. The other thing that they've worked very hard on doing is screwing voters, making sure that they don't get the opportunity to vote. And again, I go back to this guy who's the chairman of the state government committee here in Pennsylvania, Charles McElhaney, a senator, who said, quote, he sees no proof that people are casting illegal ballots. There's no proof that it's going on. There's no proof that there's a problem, but he's going to push forward because his governor and the House of Representatives asked him to do it. And again, you know, I can't, you know, I remember my mother talking about, you know, if your friends jump off a bridge, are you going to join them? Evidently, this guy would have. So any of his friends, take him to a bridge, please. Jeez, oh, man. Anyway, I've got Andy Behrs on the phone. He's the Director of Development and Communications at the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. They have filed a lawsuit along with the ACLU against what's going on in Wisconsin with their voter ID, this photo ID requirement. Andy, thanks for taking time for me.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rick.
I look at this lawsuit that you guys have filed along with the ACLU, and I understand it is the second lawsuit. One was filed by the League of Women Voters, just from a different perspective. Tell me a little about what you guys have done.
Right. So theirs is a state challenge. Right now we have the only active federal challenge of a voter ID law. So our challenge is a little more specific. It's to the law as applied to specific groups of voters. So the voters that are most likely to be affected by this law, which requires a very specific form of photo ID to vote, the type of people who are likely to be most impacted by this are homeless persons, poor persons, the elderly, disabled, and students.
And, of course, as an advocacy group to help homelessness, people who are homeless and people living in poverty, this is a perfect place for you to be fighting.
Yeah, absolutely. So we thought it was a natural fit with the ACLU, who took sort of the broader look. And, of course, our interest is specifically geared toward the homeless population. There's thousands of homeless people in Wisconsin. About 12% of Wisconsinites are living in poverty. And so these people face unique challenges. The thing about the voter ID law is that if you're someone who doesn't follow this thing very closely, the first time you hear it, it actually seems pretty reasonable. They say you need a photo ID to vote, but hey, we're going to give you a photo ID for free. So it seems very reasonable. But once you start digging a little deeper, the whole thing unravels, because in order to get the free state ID, you have to present a birth certificate or a social security card. Of course, a homeless person who's living on the street, in a lot of cases, won't have these documents. And guess what? It costs money to get them.
Right.
So what you have as a result, in effect, is a 21st century poll tax where these specific groups are forced to spend money in order to exercise their constitutional right.
You know, early on, I thought it was, you know, I'm going, as I'm thinking through it, I'm going, well, you know, how different, I got an ID in my wallet. You know, every time I rent a hotel room, I got to show my ID. Every time I go into a federal building, every time I do any of this stuff, I got to show an ID. And then I started thinking about my grandmother. My grandmother hasn't driven a car in probably 10 years.
Yep.
She has no valid identification whatsoever, but conceivably she's lived in the same house for nearly 50 years. She would have voted at the same place for 50 years.
Yep.
I don't see that it would have, I see that it would preclude her from voting.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a specific case, one of our plaintiffs that's gotten some press coverage is a woman named Ruthel Frank. She's 84, lives in Brokaw, and yeah, she has no accepted form of photo ID, and she's running into a lot of problems because her maiden name is incorrectly spelled on her birth certificate. So not only does she have to get a copy of her birth certificate, but she's going to have to pay about $200 to get it corrected. Of course, she doesn't have $200. We're talking about a woman who first voted in 1948. So this is someone who was, you know, on hand for the Give 'Em Hell Harry tour. So it's hard to believe that a woman who's been voting for this long is suddenly a danger to the democratic process.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to me. Anyone else is amazing to me. You look at all of the blood and all of the treasury that we've lost in Iraq and Afghanistan to get folks there the opportunity to vote.
Yep.
They don't have photo IDs. They walk in. They even have same-day registration. You walk in, you vote. Put your finger on the little pad, you vote it.
Yeah, exactly. And something, it's interesting that you mention the military, of course, because one of the truly ludicrous things about this is the arbitrary way that accepted documentation is chosen. For instance, active military IDs are acceptable to present, but someone with an ID card from the VA, that's not acceptable. So you have a situation where, and this is the case of one of our plaintiffs, the very thing that they fought and suffered for, the right to have a say in the direction of our country, is being arbitrarily denied to them.
It's just, it's amazing to me. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here at Andy Barra's, Director of Development and Communications at the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, NLCHP.org, the website. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Andy's name. It'll take you right there. You know, when I look at this and I say, well, okay, we're going to pass a law. Who's the law protecting, and how many people are is this going to stop? Are there any verifiable cases of someone who has shown up and said, for instance, I walk into the voting poll and say, I'm Andy Barra's, I'm here to vote. How many cases of that happens?
Right. Well, I would hope no one would want to impersonate me. But, you're absolutely right. The Wisconsin voter ID law is a solution to an invented problem. There's no evidence to suggest voter fraud by way of impersonation. There's no evidence of people pretending to be someone else to cast an extra ballot and influence an election. So right out of the gate, the thing's a non-starter. You don't need a law degree to know that it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I mean, because it seems to me that to cast that one extra vote, and we talked to a state senator here the other night, and he said, look, he goes, you know, the payoff just isn't there. If I'm going to go and I'm going to cast that one extra vote and commit what is a felony punishable by years in prison to cast one extra vote, it just doesn't make any sense that anyone would do it because the payoff's not there.
No, exactly. And, I mean, it's sort of an absurd construct when you consider that, you know, we're lucky to get 55% of the total population to vote anyway. So it's difficult to believe that there, like you said, there would be people scheming for one extra vote out of millions. It just doesn't make sense.
How much is this going to cost the state of Wisconsin? You know, here in Pennsylvania, they estimated it's going to cost $11 million to implement the program that they're talking about to get people IDs. $11 million that the state doesn't have, because here in this state, they cut $960 million from education. So spending $11 million to cure a problem that doesn't exist seems kind of dumb to me, but I'm curious about Wisconsin.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the exact number with Wisconsin, but the principle is the same. Yeah, this is going to be, you know, a lot of money that didn't need to be spent on this law. Of course, you know, we're always in favor anytime there's a circumstance where a homeless person can get access to a free ID. But as we discussed, you know, a lot of homeless people won't have the necessary documentation anyway. You actually run into a sort of bizarre catch-22. It's like the plot of a Kafka novel where there's people that need a social security card to get an ID, but to get a copy of their social security card, they need an ID. So there's this labyrinthine process that is literally impossible to navigate for some people.
We'd give you the keys of the kingdom if you had the keys.
Exactly right, yeah. It's one of those things where if you step back and get some perspective, it seems so absurd that it's difficult to believe rational people sat down and wrote this law.
To me, it makes perfect sense. What their agenda is to suppress the vote. And, you know, I go back and I play the clip quite often because it's so apropos. The guy who was the co-founder of the Heritage Foundation, he was talking to about 20,000 pastors and ministers in Dallas, Texas back in 1980. And this is what he told them.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
I think you have just summed up, 30-some years of Republican ideology. How do they suppress the vote? How do they hold the numbers down? Because they know in this state anyway, where there's 1.2 million more Democrats than Republicans, they know if they can hold that number down, they got a better shot.
Well, the political motivations and machinations are a little above my pay grade. As a nonpartisan group, we try not to divine what people were thinking when they did something. But, I mean, to look back at our history, it hasn't been perfect. There's been it was a long march toward justice as far as voting goes. And so to have a poll tax in the 21st century, after, you know, almost 50 years after Martin Luther King and Medgar Evers fought and bled and died for the right to vote, to purposefully retreat toward the darkest corners of our history is unconscionable, whatever the motivations behind it.
So you may not be able to take a position, but I can, and I will, and I did. last question I've got for you. I think this is something Eric Holder needs to get in front of. Eventually you guys are going to end up probably taking it on into through the court system, mm-hmm. but I think we've already got laws on the books. I think this is something the U.S. Attorney General has to step up and enforce the Voting Rights Act of 65. Your thoughts?
Yeah, Eric Holder gave an encouraging speech last night. We, of course, welcome any investigation by the Justice Department into, the legal ramifications here. And the Voting Rights Act does apply in the sense that it, of course, protects the rights of minority voters, and minority voters are disproportionately represented among homeless people. About 59% of the homeless population is a minority. So there's definitely an application here. We were encouraged by his words last night, and we hope he'll pursue it. And meanwhile, we're making the constitutional arguments in our litigation.
Well, good. I'd love to have you back as this thing moves forward. Please keep us up to date on what's going on.
I would love to be back. Thanks for your time, Rick.
Thanks so much. Andy Bear is Director of Development and Communications at the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. Before we take a quick break, got an email from Thomas last night. Said, talk to a couple of Republicans tonight. A poll up north of where I lived that advocated for the law didn't have their ID. Could not vote. Everybody at the polling place knew who she was. They both thought the law was stupid. I'm sure she thought it was a great idea when it was passed. And, it's what I've been saying. I forgot my ID. I got to go back and get it. You want to say, I can't wait to see people complaining over that. Quick break back after this.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
$600 million. Sounds like a lot of money, doesn't it?
That's how much Pennsylvania loses each year because of tax loopholes that allow some big corporations making millions of dollars in our state to pay less state taxes than you or I do. $600 million. That pays for huge bonuses for corporate executives instead of state programs. Does that sound fair to you? In tough economic times, more people turn to government for help. But many programs, like those that protect children and help senior citizens, have been cut so much that some services are not available. State legislators have to bring fairness to the tax system. Instead of cutting programs, they should take a balanced approach to the budget. Make big corporations pay their fair share. Call your legislators today. Tell them to close the loopholes, not cut vital programs. After all, that $600 million is coming out of our pockets. Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org.
Absence works. Maybe it's the way it's being taught or the way that it's being applied out there. But the fact of the matter is, it is the best form of to teach our children.
I gotta be honest with you. You gotta love Rick Perry. Abstinence, it works. See, it works. And granted, we've got one of the highest teen pregnancy rates in the country in Texas, but it works. See, it works real well. See, you know, we're just not doing it right. Oh, you really gotta love it. Kind of makes me laugh.
I'm ashamed to admit that I'm an atheist. But you know there's something wrong with this country when politicians think it's okay to hate on gays and non-believers in ads, as if their magic spirit guide or whatever blessed them with special a-hole privileges. Perhaps this is a good time to remember that gay and atheist presidents didn't get us into the war in Iraq, the financial crisis, or turn your mortgage into toilet paper. Maybe we should let Christians do what they do best, praying, which clearly doesn't work, and leave the governing to sodomites and infidels. Rick Perry may believe in God, but I've seen his polls, and God does not believe in Rick Perry.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess tonight, according to Scott Kies, the tweet of the day, Rick Perry is currently repeating every single mannerism from his New Hampshire speech where everyone thinks he was drunk or high. So there's that. And you got to wonder about the guy. And if it were me, I think you gotta come out and say, look, you know, my back's really killing me. I had that big surgery. Maybe I took some Rush. Maybe I visited Rush and got some Oxy. You know, did a little hillbilly heroin, kind of, you know, chop off the pain a little bit. A little help. Take the edge off. I think he's gotta say that because, you know, if you saw that New Hampshire speech, wow. He's also being beat up again. Evidently, the state of Texas has a new specialty license plate that has been approved. One state under God license plate. It's the Calvary Hill plate. See, they're going to have the three crosses there, and it's going to say one state under God. Because in his bizarre mind, there's this attack on Christianity, which I'm sorry, I'm just not getting. I'm not getting at all. On no level. And he came out with, you know, with the crazy ad that you just kind of go, really? Do we not have anything better to do than say there's a war on Christmas? There's not. And, you know, like Frum said, this alternative reality. And what they have to do is they have to create an environment where the people think they're defending something. There's no attack on guns. There's no attack on Christianity. Look. Folks, live your lives. Let's talk about what's really important. They throw these issues out here. See, there's a war on Christmas. And people get all worked up and riled up by, there's a war on Christmas. They won't let me put my nativity scene up. And then you don't focus on the fact that they haven't done a damn thing to create jobs. They haven't done anything to help this nation compete in the 21st century. They've kept us stupid by going, here, over here, shiny thing. And we, you know, like sheep to the slaughter, follow along. I wish some of these conservatives would stand up and go, yeah, all that gay stuff, fine. All the, you know, the homophobic, all of the Christianity stuff, fine. Yeah, okay, we'll concede that. Stop talking about that. How are you going to fix the economy? We're going to cut taxes. That doesn't work. Next. We're gonna deregulate. That didn't work either. Next. Let's get past the stuff that didn't work. All they're worried about is, you know, all they care about is
Obama!
That's it. That's all they care about. It's an Obama hate fest. But you see, at least I got my one state under God license plate. That's all that matters. I can't feed my kids, working for minimum wage, don't have health insurance. The whole state's going to pot. But at least I know. Calm. One state, under God, starving. Jeez. And then you got this Gingrich, who chuckle at the ignorance, at the lack of memory, at the apathy, at the amnesia. He comes out and he says our child labor laws. True to stupid, because we need to replace those union janitors with poor kids. In fact, what we're going to do is we're going to have apprentice child labor. And we're going to go get 10 of the poorest poor kids, and one of them will get the golden ticket. And as I've said, Republicans are big on lottery. You know, you vouchers, you win a lottery. You know, one gets punched, the other one's just holding shiny pieces of paper going, oh, I can see myself. So then, we see yesterday Chuck E. Cheese using child labor to use the trash compactor and the industrial mixers, violating labor law. Quoting Newt would say that's a fine thing. Let those kids work. Except in 1996 when he ran against Michael Coles, former CEO of the Great American Cookie Company. Gingrich ran an ad against Michael Coles. Why? Because the Great American Cookie Company, who Gingrich called an unscrupulous businessman, because he had gotten a violation in 1993, violated child labor laws, because they had these kids take the trash out through the freight elevator. So you know, they don't want kids operating freight elevators, and I'm okay with that. But, you know, when they took the trash out, this guy got fined, and they solved the situation. Well, Gingrich went after him full bore. How dare you let those kids take the trash out? But here we are now. We want to replace good-paying jobs, good-paying union jobs, people who are janitors. We want poor kids to do that. Does it make any sense on any level to you? He went after... if you remember, Clinton wanted to have a summer jobs program for kids. He wanted to have it in the public sector. You know, work at parks and, you know, just do some things to get you showing up on time, spending some time there, accomplishing a task. You know, things that Gingrich, and I agree with Gingrich, we need people to know you got to show up on time. Know you got to stay the whole day. Know you got to, you know, do something. And that's what Clinton's plan was going to do. 700,000 kids across the country would be able to do this. Well, Gingrich fought against it. Wanted to hire them in the private sector. So, I mean, not only has he flipped and flopped, he slipped back. But, you know, again, nobody seems to pay attention to that. And, you know, the outlets that do pick it up, well, they're not funded enough for anybody to really know. And lastly, before we take a quick break, you'll love this, Jake. She's back. Christine O'Donnell back in the fray. and look, I never wanted her to leave because she's kind of the gift that keeps on giving, you know? Just kind of always there.
I'm not a witch.
No.
I'm not a witch.
No. But she's a supporter of Mitt Romney. Evidently came out and said, you know, I like him because he's, you know, a good conservative. And the woman who was, you know, this Carol Costello, who was doing the interview, said, but, you know, he has kind of flip-flopped a little bit, right? He changed his mind a couple of times, you know, quite a bit, actually. And O'Donnell says, that's one of the things I like about him, because he's been consistent since he changed his mind. So, yeah, I did like him before, but he changed his mind, and now I like him. Which time? I mean, because there's a lot of changing. A lot of changing. Anyway, quick break, right back. Hopefully we'll be talking with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. They're still fighting over there at the Capitol. We're going to find out what's going on. Right back after this.
insanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A temporary payroll tax cut for 160 million American workers is set to expire by month's end unless Congress renews it. Instead of simply voting to renew it, House Republicans are attempting to trade their votes to extend it for other measures that would hurt federal workers. The GOP plan to extend the payroll tax cut would impose another year of pay freezes on federal workers. Those workers are already dealing with a two-year pay freeze. The Republicans also want to take even more from federal workers in exchange for extending the payroll tax cut. They want to hike the amount workers must give from their wages to pay for pensions and eliminate the Social Security supplement for workers who retire before age 62. The Federal Workers Alliance, a coalition of 22 federal unions, says that slashing the pay and benefits of one group of middle-class workers to extend a tax cut to another group of middle-class workers is the definition of insanity. The alliance says it's time Congress asked for more who can most afford it, instead of taking more money from workers. The unemployment benefits extension clock keeps ticking toward the December 31st cutoff as well, as House Republicans show no urgency in extending that lifeline for millions of jobless Americans. The Center for American Progress says without that extension, the economy would take about a $50 billion hit and would cost us another 275,000 jobs. The center says in 2010, unemployment benefits lifted 3.2 million Americans out of poverty. Massey Energy was at fault for that mine tragedy that took 29 lives in April of 2010. Jesse Russell reports.
Last week, the Labor Department released a nearly 1,000-page document regarding the Upper Big Branch mine explosion, which saw 29 mine workers lose their lives. The findings of the report show that the practices and policies of Massey Energy were the root cause of the April 5, 2010 tragedy. Even with the numerous pages of evidence against the corporation, the Justice Department announced on December 6 it would not pursue criminal charges against the mining company. The company will only pay $209 million, with only $47 million of that going to the families of the victims. The penalties will be paid by Alpha Natural Resources, the company that bought Massey Energy this year. However, the buck doesn't stop with the mining company. The Mine Safety and Health Administration plans to conduct an internal investigation into how the agency may have failed in its role. Meanwhile, even with 29 deaths and a history of violations under the company he once oversaw, former executive Don Blankenship incorporated McCoy Coal Group in Kentucky earlier this year. According to Bloomberg News, the company has yet to apply for any mining permits.
This newscast made possible in part by the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and by ULICO, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
All the things you want are real.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. I know I said the tweet of the day was from Scott Kies, because I guess Perry's acting like the drunken idiot again. But I just got the tweet of the day, and this has got to be it. State Representative Bloom, my representative. Oh, jeez. School reform dead for now in PA House. Not a good night for PA kids. PSEA still ruling this state. Sad. And I guess, you know, if you look at the golden ticket bill that he was in favor of, I think that would have hurt kids more than anything because you would have destroyed, it would have been the beginning of destroying public education. But again, it shows me which side of this he's on. Anyway, our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, over at the Capitol tonight. Irwin, what's going on?
Well, so far it's a pretty good night for Pennsylvania's children. Despite an end-run, last-minute, last-ditch, unconstitutional effort to amend an innocuous bill having to do with appointments to military colleges by members of the General Assembly being amended through the efforts of the Republican House floor leadership in general and Representative floor leader, Mike Terzai, from Allegheny County in particular, an over 100-page amendment he put forth, didn't get into print until sometime last night, to be voted on today, never seen before, that would have dramatically expanded charter schools, quadrupled the earned income, the educational tax credit for big corporations to pass out taffy and gifts to major private schools and get a tax credit, not even a tax deduction, Rick, but a tax credit for that. And not more than 3 minutes ago, five minutes ago, at the final minute of the final hour that the House could be in session, by a vote of 105-90, that amendment was defeated, and with its defeat, the expansion of charter schools, the expansion of this baloney tax credit, and the effort to create a publicly funded voucher system whereby private schools would just be able to print money altogether with taxpayer support have all been defeated. And I think they've been defeated for the session. They've certainly been defeated for the year. And it is an exceptional day for Pennsylvania's children who were the pawns in this multi-billion-dollar scam.
Outstanding. And good on all of those people who stood up, especially the people on the Republican side of the aisle who stood up and said, this isn't the right way to go. And I look at this, as you said, they printed this up last night.
Well, they really didn't even get it into print. They got it into email last night. It didn't show up in actual print till this morning. At 1:30 this morning, I was reading a copy on my iPhone because that was the only way it was available. And we have a rule that, you know, anything that's to be voted on has to be posted and in print by 2 o'clock the prior day in the House's operating rules. But Representative Terzai, because he's the floor leader for the Republicans, filed three amendment numbers without a body to them, and he called them ghost amendments or placeholders. And the first one was taking all of Senate Bill 1, which included the vouchers and all of that stuff, and doing a gut replacement and putting it into this other bill's House Bill 560.
So what Senate happened? Bill. What happened to the people who were going to make sure that the pay raise type thing never happened again, and make sure there was open government and transparency and all of the sunshine and all of the procedure, and put things online, and we're going to make sure the public has an opportunity to see what happened to that Republican Party?
You sound awfully cynical, my friend. What happened to that public Republican Party is nothing. Rhetoric is one thing. Actions are another. We've seen the actions of the Republican floor leadership in this session of the House of Representatives time and time again, when it was packing committees, when it was ramrodding through changes in the rules without debate, when it was clipping off the ability of members of the General Assembly to speak their mind on the floor before a vote was taken. Time and time again, this platitude had no latitude. And this platitude of openness and sunshine just has evaporated. And what we see, candidly, is among their own members, there was a revolt today in the caucus. I haven't seen, because this is too new, I haven't seen the roll call in this 105-90 vote. But I'm sure that there were Democrats that voted against us and that there were Republicans that voted for us. This was not an issue that operated strictly on party line.
Right. Well, it's about the issue.
This is an issue about money. This is an issue about destroying and decimating democracy. This is an issue about the future of our children and how we treat the single most precious asset a society has, our kids.
Yeah. I was just talking to a Tea Party. My dentist actually is a Tea Party guy. And he was lecturing me on how the health care, the Affordable Care Act, was just rammed down the throat of the nation. You know, that whole year-long debate we had over health care, it was just rammed down our throats. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, I wonder what my Tea Party friends think of someone like Bloom, a Tea Partier, who supports this.
Well, it's hard to imagine the double standard that exists. But indeed, that's exactly what exists. Time and time again, there's a double standard. When it helps people, it was ramrodded through. When it lines the pockets of charlatan business people who want to be able to steal taxpayer dollars to run these charter schools, with no oversight, with no accountability, with no transparency, with no commitment to ethical practices, nothing that we came to understand over the course of centuries is the minimum standard for the use and expenditure of public funds, then that's ramrodding through.
Amazing.
You know?
Early on in the program, we had James Rohrbuck, Democrat from Philadelphia, and he put out a piece of a proposal that he calls All Students Can Succeed. And as I read through it, I'm going, this is exactly what we've been talking about on the program for the longest time. There are schools that are struggling. Let's focus on fixing them.
Well, I'm very pleased to say that Representative Rohrbuck, who has passed that wonderful piece of information and documentation on to you, and who spoke with passion tonight, only a few minutes ago, in encouraging his colleagues to vote against the amendment, has been working very closely with us in crafting the legislation and the legislative proposal that you just mentioned. And no less recently than yesterday morning, I had the really uplifting experience of being in Representative Rohrbuck's office in his conference room, working on the fine points of that legislative proposal and working hard toward trying to figure out how, in the context of this hammer and fist approach that some of the Republican leadership has, how we can get this legislation from Representative Rohrbuck contemplated and considered on the floor of the House, because it is so forward-thinking. And I'm really very proud to say that I've had a hand in it.
And, you know, it's what we've been talking about for the longest time. But let me ask you this. Now that the voucher bill seems to be dead for now, do you think it's possible that the people who want this privatization scheme, can look beyond the defeat that evidently they're having and look to really solving the problems that public schools have, these handful of public schools have?
Well, I think that you're confusing apples and oranges here. We need to look beyond this so that we can fix the problems and so that we can also learn from the good that comes in so many schools. As Representative Rohrbuck said in his remarks, he's a graduate of a school, a traditional school district-run school in Philadelphia, that today, this year, was not the number one school in Philadelphia, not even the number one school in eastern Pennsylvania. It's the number one school in Pennsylvania. It wasn't a charter school. It wasn't a private school. It wasn't a parochial school. It wasn't a religious school. It wasn't a sectarian school. It's a traditional school district-run school. And we need to learn from those examples what we can do in other schools to make them stronger and better and safer, better prepare our kids for the world that they face. Understand, when a number of years ago the original charter school law was passed in Pennsylvania, it had provisions that said very clearly and very directly that charter schools were to be laboratories where we learned and experimented with alternative practices, and that those best practices, when they bubbled to the top, would be shared with all of our schools, because these were, in fact, taxpayer-funded and remain taxpayer-funded public schools. They are public charter schools.
Right.
And what we had tonight was this going full circle. One of the very quietly snuck-in proposals in this amendment that just got defeated was a striking of the language that recognized charters to be laboratories that had to share, and instead really stood for the proposition, and this is shocking, Rick, stood for the proposition that these charter operators could collect taxpayer dollars and keep a secret about not only how they spent them,
wow,
but how they achieved whatever results they achieved.
Proprietary education.
Proprietary education, and shockingly, as Representative Rohrbuck pointed out in the debate on this legislation, while more than 75% of the school district operated schools in Pennsylvania meet or exceed average yearly progress, AYP, they refer to it as, in the measurement of public school students' achievement, only 60% of the students in charter schools, or the charter schools, 60% reach AYP. All at taxpayer expense, And even more shockingly, only 17% of the so-called cyber charter schools meet AYP this
year.
Wow.
But, you know, in bringing that point up, that, again, I think highlights the fact that they really they want to privatize and profitize education.
Well, they don't want to privatize it. They just want to profitize it. That's the interesting thing. They want to privatize it because they want to still confiscate taxpayers' dollars, but then they want to put it in private hands. So that's profitizing it, but not privatizing it.
So taking all the skimming the cream off the top, but still making us responsible for the cows and the upkeep.
That's exactly right. This is the same as the story of FedEx. We have a postal service, but the postal service not only allows competition, but has competition from FedEx that skims off the cream. And then FedEx has the colossal gall, and we have the immense stupidity of putting FedEx boxes on U.S. Postal Service property for people to make drop-offs.
Yep. It's amazing to me. Last question I've got for you, and today, a big victory for education. I understand they were talking about the UC bill. Where are we at with that?
Well, they passed legislation in the House that will allow the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to issue $4+ billion, that's billion with a B, dollars worth of bonds, so that the taxpayers can pay off the debt that the business community has accumulated for failing to be adequately financing the unemployment compensation system. You recall on earlier shows we have talked about how the taxable wage base of $8,000 a year, that employers only pay unemployment compensation tax on $8,000, the first $8,000 that a worker earns. Workers pay on 100 cents of every dollar they earn, all the way up to whatever their total earnings is.
Right.
Well, that $8,000, when adopted, was approximately 50% of the statewide average annual wage. Today, that same $8,000 is scarcely 19% of the statewide average annual wage. And had they kept pace with the average annual wage over the period from 1984, when that was adopted, through today, we would have no debt. But they refused to do that. And so we have a debt now in the face of this protracted period of very high unemployment. And tonight, the House of Representatives adopted legislation that allows the state to issue bonds so they can borrow up to $4.2 billion to pay off the business community's debt that has accrued from the business community not paying a reasonable share, a fair share. The share, in fact, that they agreed to back in the 1980s into the Unemployment Compensation Trust Fund.
So has anything been done to correct our solvency problem, or is this just kicking the can down the road?
This is beyond kicking the can down the road. They're trying to constantly make the victims of our economy, the victims of unemployment and their families, responsible for the debt that the business community has accrued. And to try to do that by slashing benefits, restricting eligibility even more, coming up with offsets, like the most recent one they did in June where they offset people's severance pay that they earned while they were working. They offset that against unemployment compensation eligibility. So they have done any number of things in June, again today, but the one thing they haven't done is address solvency, even vaguely.
So I guess we can expect another bill to go after cutting benefits even further as this problem gets worse.
Oh, now, now that we've authorized this borrowing of $4.2 billion, you can anticipate, let's say it this way, your listeners are hearing it here first. You can anticipate that there will be another legislative rush to do something to strip the victims of unemployment of their benefits and their eligibility. And they'll do it this time by saying, see, we owe $4.2 billion because of these people.
These people.
We have to pay it off. These people.
Yep. Jeez.
So,
a good day today.
A good day today. One of the things that made it good as well was the legislature, particularly the House of Representatives, had on its calendar some legislation that would have dramatically increased the threshold for prevailing wage attachment, slashed the wages of construction workers in Pennsylvania on publicly funded jobs in just an enormous fashion by increasing the threshold from $25,000 before prevailing wage minimum wage requirements attached to $185,000. It is pretty clear that the House leadership didn't have the votes to pass that either, because they didn't even put it up for a vote, even though it was on their calendar.
Well, that, so, more good news.
So the message here and the takeaway, if I may be so bold, for all of our listeners, is that when the voice of workers is heard in the legislative halls, it rings clear, it rings true, and it rings honest. And today was one of the days when we demonstrated that with absolute clarity. And the workers of Pennsylvania were well protected, despite the fact that the forces of evil had really marshaled their assets in very serious ways to hurt our children, to hurt our construction workers, to hurt our unemployed, to hurt our underemployed, to hurt people who are sick, to hurt people who are infirm, to hurt people who depend on their government for basic services and basic protections that they cannot have for themselves. And the workers' representatives, in the name of the Pennsylvania Building and Construction Trades Council, in the name of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, in the name of the Philadelphia-Pittsburgh Federations of Teachers, in the name of PSEA, the Pennsylvania State Education Association, joined today, by the way, by their employers, the Pennsylvania School Boards Association, and rural education groups, standing together, shoulder to shoulder, in a single purpose, with a single voice, have said no, clearly and effectively. And through them and their members and their affiliated organizations, they've said no in a way that rings very loud, particularly in the face of a government where the House, the Senate, and the governor's mansion are all controlled by people who were not endorsed by those worker representatives.
It's amazing stuff, and it's a testament to the power of folks sticking together and the power of mobilizing people to really get reach out and contact their representatives. A great day, Irwin. I appreciate it. Thanks for the great news. Welcome. Very welcome.
Thank you, and good to be here tonight. As somebody said to me as I was wandering in the Capitol building an hour or so ago, this is like going into a football game where everybody in the other team weighs 275 pounds. Is in perfect physical condition and composed exclusively of a group of all-American athletes facing off against a bunch of old and dowdy guys like me who are balding and portly. And somehow or another, the score is still nothing.
There you go. Outstanding.
So, all right, good night.
We live to fight another day. Irwin,
exactly.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. See ya. Bye-bye.
Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
How small can a giant corporation get? I don't mean in size, but in spirit. Once again, America's biggest commercial empire, Walmart, is displaying its incredibly shriveled ethical center by whacking the already meager healthcare benefits that hundreds of thousands of workers count on. Just a couple of years ago, this $400 billion a year retailing colossus tried to hush critics of its Dickensian labor policies by ballyhooing a bare-bones healthcare plan for its associates. The insurance scheme had such high deductibles, however, that barely half of its employees bought into it. Now, even that benefit is being yanked from the 40% of Walmart's employees who are part-time workers. Also, insurance premiums and deductibles are being dramatically jacked up for thousands of full-time workers. For example, one full-timer, who's paid only $12,000 a year, will see her premium more than double to about $3,300 a year, a fourth of her income. I won't be able to afford the insurance, she says, and I really can't go without insurance because I have a heart problem. Top executives in the board of directors of this enormously profitable corporation also have a heart problem. They are taking advantage of America's raging unemployment crisis to stiff their workforce, since these low-wage, non-union employees desperately need the jobs and have no power to stand up to the corporation's greed. A Walmart PR flack says that decisions to whack the workers, quote, were not easy, but they strike a balance between managing costs and providing quality care and coverage. This is Jim Hightower saying, care and coverage for whom? For the top executives, of course. They get full health care coverage from the corporation. How's that for boosting morale? And for morality? For more information, go to farrespect.org/healthcare.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show. I got a
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So, you know, I'm looking at this, and I got to be honest. The more you look at it, no vouchers, no privatization of the wine and spirit shops, no destruction of prevailing wage. These Republicans here, they're not going to be able to go to their big meetings. They're not going to be able to go to the ALEC meetings. They're not going to be able to look other Republicans across the country in the eye. They haven't been able to do what some of the crazier states have done. They weren't able to ram through what Wisconsin and Ohio and places like Maine and Florida and Tennessee and Michigan. They haven't been able to get that stuff through. Now, understand, the people in those states are rising up. So there's part of me that kind of worries that the insanity didn't go through here. It was pushed back. So that we're going to kind of, you know, lay back and go, you know what? Things are working just fine. We were able to hold off the really bad stuff. And understand, the real bad stuff was held off by really an extraordinary effort of labor and community groups coming together on a par that I have never seen really before, and that is not going to get any headlines, is not going to be on the evening news. It just happened. And what's worrisome is, again, here, you know, we're not going to have, going into the next election, that was like Wisconsin has, this fire that, hey, they're stealing from us and we need to go after them. So, you know, while I'm excited, I'm happy and thrilled that, you know, some of the really ugly stuff has stopped, at least for now, I wonder if this is going to hurt or help in the 2012 election season.
I think Mr. Aronson hit it on the nose when he said this wasn't a Democrat or Republican issue, and the fact that I think later
this was the core Republicans wanted it. There's a handful of Republicans who didn't.
The point I'm trying to make is that some of these districts they got a lot of pressure from the constituents, from their voters, and they were able to persuade enough Republicans to vote against it. There is a huge public outcry, and I can tell you, just watching the media, organizations like the Commonwealth Foundation is another organization. It wasn't just huge money; it was a lot of powerful organizations that put a full court press on for months. And 2 months ago, Rick, it looked like a snowball coming down the hill, and you weren't going to stop it.
Yep.
I mean, I got to be honest. I mean, I'm ecstatic, but I'm a little surprised, and great for them.
Well, I think, you know, when you start making these outlandish claims, especially you look at the Tea Party think tank saying, oh, our schools are hell holes, and the only way we can save them is we privatize them, that made people go, hold on, you've gone a bit too far. You've now gone off the edge. Our school system is not that bad. There are a handful that are struggling. And I had heard at one point 141. That's the number that I kept seeing, 141 schools in a state with some 3,300. 141 doesn't seem like all that large of a number. More than we should have, yes, but very manageable and very capable of fixing. This bill, this last-minute bill that Turd's Eye wanted to ram through, just had it printed up last night and got out to people this morning. Again, love that transparency. Only would have focused on 60 schools. and I guess none in Pittsburgh. So I don't know how he expected this to go through. What this to me was their last-ditch effort to be able to stick a flag in the ground and say, we won something to make the governor look good.
Well, and labor and its allies did a good job, you know, and when you start looking at the stark numbers, the bottom line, 75% of public schools reach the AYP. It's only 60% of the charter schools, and only, I believe he said 14%
17.
Of 17 of cyber. Wow, that is just, those numbers just say it all.
Yeah, so, and the other part of it is I'm glad to hear the prevailing wage thing stuck. And people go, well, why is prevailing wage so important to you? Well, it's important to me because I don't want to end up like South Carolina. You know, Ike calls in here pretty often. Ike's a good guy. I like him, but he's in a crummy state. The reality is if you have a situation where there's no say in how the state money is being spent, because I seem to believe if we're going to spend money as a state, it should help promote job growth within our state. If we can buy products like steel, for instance, if here in Pennsylvania we could buy steel made in Pittsburgh, we should do that first and foremost. We may pay a penny or two extra, but it's worth it for the state because it generates revenue within the state, more money back into the coffers, something we should think about. If we have the opportunity to raise the wage floor so that our workers have a better standard of living, we should be doing those things. And to me, that's what the prevailing wage law does. It creates a situation where we say, you know what? In this state, if you're someone who drives one of those steamrollers, you're going to make $20 an hour. Where in South Carolina, they say, hey, can you drive a steamroller? Oh, yeah, sure, I can do anything. $8 an hour. Good luck. Get to work. And that's the kind of person you get. I want high skill. I want highly competent and well-paid construction workers building the school that my kids are going to sit in. I want them building that bridge that I'm driving over. I mean, we don't think about it like this. I mean, the think tank over there, they say, well, we can save 30% of all construction costs. Ridiculous. I mean, did we fail third grade math? In order for us to save 30% of the construction cost, the construction workers would have to pay the state to work for them. And all I say, you know, if you want to go back to the days of patronage, that's one way to do it. So if they would have lifted those thresholds, that would have given every little county commissioner and every little city mayor or city councilman or whatever enormous power. To say my brother-in-law needs a job. You ever clean? You ever build something? No. I'll give you this contract. You can learn. And no bids. That's what's in it for me. For me, I think what should happen: everything should be bid online, so that I can go and look and see what the bids are. See if I can actually save money. See if it's actually working. But they don't want that kind of transparency. No, no. That would be too much like common sense. But I guess we don't do that.
Not enough of it. If I can go back to the voucher issues, there was one of the key people at the Ticky Tank, and he was on one of the majors, and I'm not going to name it, but you know who I'm talking about, the big station here in Harrisburg. He was on for 3 hours, and the things he was saying, you know, like, this is about freedom, we got to get the voucher issue. He's trying to make the point that, well, this is about freedom. We got to get back to the roots of our Constitution and our founding fathers. And he was making outrageous claims about how much money it was costing the people of Pennsylvania, as if it was not an investment in their children and in their education and the future of the state, as if we were just throwing that money away. But these are the kind of things that they threw out to the public to scare them. And thank God it didn't work.
Well, shame on any idiot who would buy that. I mean, you know, at some point you hope that our education system...
Unfortunately, some people do.
You would hope our education system created critical thinkers. And look, if you think I've said something outrageous, call me, question me on it, but don't just take what I say, don't take what I say at face value. Run it through your own filters. I take nothing anyone tells me at face value. I like facts. You know, I'm not so big on belief. I like facts. I like to know what things are tangible. I can hold them in my hand. pretty simple stuff. Anyway, a good night. And, you know, I think the Republicans here in the state are going to go home tonight and go, I'm just not going to be able to show my face at the ALEC meeting.
Well, I guess my question is, and I'm hoping I know the answer, are they coming back next year? And I realize next year is going to be tougher because it's an election year, but will they try it again?
Not an election year. I think you're going to see a lot of milk toast. I think you're going to see. I don't think you'll see a lot of divisive stuff. It's an election year. Nobody mm-hmm. wants to tick anybody off. Nobody wants to spark that outrage. You passed that something like that divisive, where you obviously couldn't get it through your own caucuses when the Republicans control this state by overwhelming numbers in the Senate. It is 30-20.
It
30
is.
To 20. Republicans control. But 30 to 20 in the House. What is it? 118? I forget what the numbers are, but
sure.
it's like 28
well,
seats.
If you look at the reapportionment efforts, Rick, now what they're doing long term, I think it's going to hurt the Republicans. What they're doing is, yes, they're making more seats safe for the Republicans, but they're spreading out their wealth. And what that means is, in a big election, like a presidential, where you have a huge turnout, those people who are in swing districts or close to it become that much more vulnerable. So that's why I think you're seeing some of these votes. They realize, and they're smart politicians, next year the intensity of that race is going to be, it's going to be huge next year. And if you make any mistakes now, you're going to be held accountable.
Yep, we'll see. Quick break, right back after this with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. We're right back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call them at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., our bureau chief out there, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
I guess someone's proposing new Medicare plans? Oh, I can't
wait.
Yes,
yes, yes, yes. House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan.
Uh-oh.
He of the right-wing social engineering, joined by Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon.
Uh-oh.
Together.
Yeah, okay. Where's this going?
You want me to hit you with it? Okay.
Please.
Well
no, not really. I really don't want to know how badly we're going to lose on this, but tell me what's going on.
Starting in 2022, Medicare stays. Seniors would still receive a set amount of money from the government to buy insurance as they would under the Medicare proposal Ryan included in his budget blueprint. But the new approach would let that subsidy, which is known as premium support, rise or fall along with the actual cost of the policies, which would create more protection for seniors. And but Medicare, as Medicare, would stay. So the idea, Wyden says, the idea of adding traditional Medicare to Ryan's premium support plan combines the best ideas of both parties, creating, quote, the opportunity for progressives and conservatives to come together and address the real challenges of the federal entitlement program, rising costs, and an aging population.
Okay. So we're gonna add this this private mechanism into that, because now people are going to be able to go out into the private market. Are we going to continue as we've been doing with Medicare Part C and over-subsidizing to get people into the private market for this?
It doesn't say in what I have from the Washington Post about Part C. It just says that they are committed to providing government health coverage for people over 65, and they so that Medicare will continue.
So they're not going to raise it to 67 or 69 or 100, 65
is the plan. No.
Okay, so that I guess that's a good thing. How about me being able to buy into it as somebody who's 44? Will I be able to buy into Medicare?
Doesn't say that.
See, that would be a nice option. I mean, if we're going to have health insurance compete, let me buy into the cheaper plan.
Yeah, they also say forcing private insurers to bid to provide Medicare coverage and encouraging beneficiaries to choose the plan with the lowest costs, they think the measure could drive costs down further than the price controls that the current law would impose on the private sector. So they think this takes some of the politics out of it. Now, I think that there are some people on both sides of the aisle who are not happy about this, that this is coming out tomorrow because they were hoping to use the issue in the election.
I got to be honest. You know, I love the fact that the Republicans have pushed this all the way out to where now we're actually talking about having a voucher for health care. Originally, a couple years back, you just said, hey, let's voucher health care. The Democrats would have rabidly said no. But now they have caved, and now they've done what Democrats tend to do, and they have surrendered to the idea of the right, and, oh, let's try and make it less bad.
Yeah.
Just a thought. Big celebration, the end of the war in Iraq?
Yes, the President and the First Lady went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina today, and it was 3 years after he campaigned against the war, actually near Fort Bragg. President Obama returned and hailed the hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops who fought to establish the, quote, sovereign, stable, and self-reliant Iraq that America's going to be leaving behind this month. And he basically marked the imminent departure by telling hundreds of active service members that the war was a source of great controversy at home. And he stressed that those who fought, as well as their families, would always be remembered and honored for their service, welcomed them home. And said Iraq is not a perfect place, but we are leaving behind a sovereign, stable, and self-reliant Iraq with a representative government that was elected by its people. We're building a new partnership between our nations.
Yeah, elected by their people. And the people who had same-day registration, the people who didn't have photo IDs, the people, amazingly, you know, who didn't, you know, we kind of pushed for it. No voter suppression over there. We come home, lots of voter suppression.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it is what we do here, I guess. I'm still trying to figure it out, but we do. So good. Is that a campaign? Do you think that's a campaign promise kept? I mean, considering
the fact
that we
campaign promise kept. It was a deal that was broken under the previous president that we would get out at the end of December of this year.
So it was going to happen anyway. It was what you're saying.
Yes.
Okay. Good. 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 Because I still see that we were going to have people there. They're just not going to be troops. I guess we're going to have a bunch of mercenaries, correct?
Yeah, but not that many, really.
Oh, okay. I thought the number was in the 15 to 20,000 range.
Well, I'd heard about 5.
Okay. Well, close enough.
But who knows? It could be a fluctuating number.
Good. The Republicans have rejected any tax on the millionaires. Yesterday, they rammed through the Middle Class Tax Relief and Job Creation Act. Today, where are we at?
In the House. Yes, and today, Harry Reid wanted to get a quick vote on it in the Senate so that it could get rejected, and Mitch McConnell, the minority leader, thwarted him on that, said, no, we need to do the spending bill first, and because that's going to outline the funding priorities for much of the government through September 2012 and ensure that federal agencies don't close down this week because, you know, the lights go out on Friday. And Harry Reid said, no, we need to do this first. And the reason Harry Reid is saying that is because Mitch McConnell has indicated, and there is some concern among Democrats, that if they do the spending bill first and get that through, they're going to go home. And they won't do the payroll tax extension.
Right.
Or they will put pressure on the Democrats to just do it their way because they will have no more leverage.
So there is some strategic thought there after all.
Oh, yes. Harry Reid's got a lot of strategic thought. he's not the one who's necessarily entirely caving, but there was a meeting at the White House today.
And
in which
go?
there was cave talk. And the cave talk was that the surtax, 1.9% surtax on income over $1 million may have to go. Now, I have been saying for a couple of weeks now that it was never going to be in the final deal. It was never going to be in the final
deal. Yeah, any rational person knows that that's the protected class. They're sacrosanct. We can't touch them.
And it was always going to be a negotiating tactic. It's just, I think, for progressives, it's very, very disappointing that once again they caved.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is, now nobody's admitted that this has happened yet, but it's going to happen. They will cave on this. The interesting thing is, will they cave on the Keystone XL pipeline, or will they insist that comes out?
I don't see how you can not insist that that comes out. And the other thing with the EPA, I don't know why those are in that bill.
Nobody knows, because they have nothing to do with payroll tax.
Well, because they're the poison pills. I mean, they're meant to destroy it. They're meant to say, well, we tried. You just wouldn't do it. And lastly, Christine, the witch is back. Christine O'Donnell's back in the news. Who dug her up?
Ding dong. Oh, she dug herself up. I mean, she can cast spells. She can dig herself up. She's decided, she's been thinking about who she wants to endorse. Because her endorsement is key.
Does anybody care?
She decided to endorse Mitt Romney.
Does anybody care?
No, but she's trying to make sure people do. And she said today on CNN, that's one of the things that I like about him, because he's been so consistent since he changed his mind.
I saw that. I had to laugh. Well, yes.
Yeah.
And when he changes his mind again, I'll love that too.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, but she's warning the Tea Party not to support Newt Gingrich, saying he's not real Tea Party. He's fake.
And Romney is Tea Party?
Well, she's saying he's basically more consistently conservative. She's saying he's humble enough to admit he doesn't always have the right answers and is open to make the necessary changes. I think that she's done an analysis and she thinks that Romney can win.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Wait a second. Rational thought, intelligence... Tea Party? I'm not seeing the correlation.
No, I'm not sure there is any. We are talking about Christine O'Donnell here.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Looks like she's put on a couple of pounds. I guess, you know, running away from the law. And since that stopped, she's had time to sit down a little bit.
Indeed.
There you go. Victoria Jones, always great talking with you.
Thank you so much.
Victoria Jones Talk Radio News Service. Now to find out what's going on across the street. What do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. Reapportionment has been on the radar for the last couple of weeks. We talked about the real brouhaha over the Republicans in the state Senate reapportioning Harrisburg out of the 15th and into the 48th. There was some real outcry, not only among Democrats, but among some of the counties initially. Now they went back and drew up a second proposal and kind of softened some of the criticism from the Republican side. But apparently the Republicans in the congressional delegation are not pleased with some of the districts that have been drawn up. Joe Pitts, who is the longest standing congressman in the Pennsylvania delegation, is from Lancaster County. He also represents parts of Chester. And the new reapportionment would take some of his district and give it to the 7th Congressional District, which is presently held by Pat Meehan, who is a former federal prosecutor who lives in Delaware. Reason the Republicans are doing that, the suburban counties of Delaware, Montgomery, to some degree Chester, have been increasingly voting Democratic. So to protect the 7th Congressional District, they're taking of some of the Joe Pitts district, and by the way, he won by 31 votes, so he's in a pretty safe district.
You won by 31%.
31%. I'm 31. Yeah, points. I'm sorry. Did I say okay?
You said votes.
Votes. I'm sorry. 31 points by a percentage margin of 31%, which is huge. So they want to transfer some of those votes to him. He has been criticized by fellow Republicans as being selfish. I'm not so sure. If I were him, I'd probably feel the same way. Apparently, all that criticism was for naught, because apparently today the Senate voted 26 to 24 to pass it. The House will follow on Thursday. I have to mention one other thing, and I was remiss in mentioning this. The one thing negative about the Republicans gerrymandering Harrisburg out of the 15th, which wasn't mentioned, I mean, first of all, I think it's just an obvious political ploy, and I think it just smacks of hardcore politics to the, and the public be damned. But one thing that hasn't been discussed, because of the fact that Harrisburg will not be able to vote for a state senator until the year 2014. Now, why is that significant? The last time they voted for it was in 2008. And they would have voted next year for their senator, but the fact that they're going to be moved into a new district means that they will not be given a chance to vote for their state senator till the year 2014, which, again, takes away the voters' rights in that district. Now, the outcry of all of this, I love what Terry Madonna has said about these redistricting efforts by the Republicans. I love Terry, and he's usually right on, and I think this time he was. He said this: this is first and foremost a political process. It's about power. The motive here is to protect incumbents and to pack Democrats into six districts and leave Republicans with 12 safe seats. They've done a masterful job in a sense. It's hard to believe this doesn't substantially protect them. If you want to create an incumbent protection map, you could not have done a better job, and he's exactly right. Back to you, Rick.
All righty, let's take a quick break. Right back after this to wrap things up.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2nd, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began the first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy. The Rick Smith Show.
I want it all.
Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, that's probably the best place to get it. If there's a segment you want to hear again, right there at thericksmithshow.com, we do archive all of our programs for your enjoyment, entertainment. If you got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. If you've got a question, comment, something on your mind, tell me about something I said you didn't like or you did, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. The Carlisle area has a, well, I wouldn't say a favorite son. Did you see the story in Los Angeles of the guy walking down the street just shooting cars, shooting for what appeared to be no real reason? Ended up killing this this music executive, the shooter from Carlisle. Actually graduated from Shippensburg High School, or Shippensburg University. Graduated from Carlisle High School. Not quite sure what was going on there. The 26-year-old just decided, you know what? Guess he broke up with his girlfriend and just wanted to end it all.
Wasn't a veteran, was he?
No. Just a 26-year-old guy walking down the street with a .40 caliber handgun. So there you go. Happy days. Saw this statistic should make the people who think there's a war on Christmas and a war on Christians and a war on traditional marriage. See, I've been saying for the longest time, all the homophobes, if you want gay people to stop engaging in what evidently you claim to think that you know what they're doing and don't like, let them get married. They'll stop. Trust me. And the other part of this is, statistically, you're no longer that big of a voting bloc. The number of adults who are married right now has dropped to a record low. In fact, we've seen changes in people's attitudes towards marriage and society, and this is scaring the hell out of the Rick Perrys and all of the folks on that side. Only 51% of adults 18 and older right now are married, according to a Pew Research poll. According to their analysis, a pretty big decline in just the 10 years since the last one, where they said 57%. So you kind of got to wonder, what's going on here? I know the economy is, you would think during the economy, people would be sticking together. There'd be probably less divorce. But I would have to say, judging from those numbers, you absolutely have to wonder. And for me, again, it's, my grandfather always had a saying, don't worry about me, worry about yourself. And I think if more people did that, they worried about themselves, we would be a much better place. Worry about what you do in the confines of your home. Make sure you're doing the right thing. And let the guy over there, as long as he's within the confines of the law with consenting adults, leave him alone. Leave him alone. Anyway, a good day here in Pennsylvania. I'm very happy to hear all of the good news we got from our good friend Attorney Erwin Aronson. The voucher bill was bounced back. Also, the threshold bills bounced back. I think tomorrow we're going to try and get someone on the wine and spirits shops, because that looks like it's dead as well. That whole twist and turn to try and salvage something seems desperate. I think that may go down a defeat. So, again, you got to wonder, will they be able to show their face in their caucuses?
I can't wait to hear the public spin tomorrow.
There you go. Have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Again, thericksmithshow.com, the best place to get the program. Question, comment, something on your mind, rick@thericksmithshow.com. See you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.